Shall we begin, if you're sitting comfortably?
More than comfortably.
Oh, that's what I'd like to hear. So, we're welcome to this audio recording. This is Jonathan Clark.
I'm Brian Larkin.
Hey, and we are having a little discussion. As part of the Fully Booked Bootcamp program, we thought we'd have a separate discussion in this audio about the topic of positioning. Positioning is a fascinating topic when it comes to growing your business or any industry. And of course, we've got a slightly unconventional look at how we do that. What we want to do in this next space of time is discuss what positioning actually is, why it's important, why you should do it in any industry, in any field that you're currently in and that you want to dominate, and several strategies for actually how you can do that. A massive part of any business strategy is how their product, service or treatment is positioned in the marketplace, or the minds of the marketplace, I should say. And ideally, we want to position you as a specialist in your industry. So this audio is about giving you a number of ways to do that. So every day, I see business owners, and you'll see business owners, and you'll see various marketing messages, advertising messages. Everyone's vying to get competitive advantage, to get their company taken more seriously. So companies write press releases, they'll spend small fortunes on glossy brochures, glossy websites, logos, branding, the old name awareness thing, letterheads, dressing their staff in corporate livery, leasing new cars, so on and so on and so on. Those are ways to do it. There are more efficient ways of doing it. You probably would like to know what they are.
Please tell me. Tell us all.
Well, here's some ways that work. Let me give you some examples, for instance, just to kind of frame this in your mind. And you'll find this particularly interesting. How hard do you think it is for Steven Spielberg to get a job directing a movie?
No brainer.
Why?
Because he's famous.
He's also more than that, isn't he?
Well, far more than that.
Isn't he viewed as an expert at his craft?
Yes.
So people will seek him out to offer him work. He doesn't have to seek them out at all.
Okay.
Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
And I'd emphasise that more important than being famous is that he is perceived as being a specialist. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Another example, in the medical community, who gets paid more, a cardiologist or a GP?
GP.
Cardiologist.
Really? Well, actually, I dated a cardiologist at one point.
Did you?
Yeah.
And did you know how much she made?
Yes.
Now you have to go and
That's how we broke up.
Oh no.
I went with the GP.
Well, speaking of oral surgery, an oral surgeon compared to a dentist, who earns more?
Oral surgeon.
Indeed. Why?
Because it's more specialised.
It's viewed as specialised. People take the recommendations without question. Their opinions hold a lot more weight, and therefore they command much higher incomes. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you drove a Ferrari and started having engine problems, would you take it to your local garage or would you take it to a specialist Ferrari dealership?
If I had a choice. Well, if I had a choice.
Did she have a choice?
Uh-huh. You mean the cardiologist?
Yes.
No.
Okay, okay.
But, okay, Ferrari.
Ferrari. Where would you take it? Ferrari dealer?
Yeah.
What?
Well, they're more trained in the field. They're specialised in repairing Ferrari cars.
And people will also pay extra to make sure a Ferrari mechanic works on a Ferrari, won't they?
Yeah.
And wouldn't you be worried handing your Ferrari in to the normal everyday garage?
Not if he was an ex-Ferrari dealer.
So the power's in the name, the power's in the experience, and the power's in how you perceive that garage or that surgeon or that specialist or that director for being an expert in the field and for having the knowledge base that you're trying to tap into. Which is where we're kind of going with this. Now, the whole reason why this is important is because at the moment, the marketplace is over-communicated. I think somebody calculated there's something like 15,000 marketing messages hitting you individually every single day of your life. So today, you've had 15,000 inputs of people trying to win your attention and win your money and win your business. There's too much noise out there. There are so many companies already out there, so many products, so many varieties of products within the same industries. There's just way too much white noise in people's heads. Add to that the fact that the public is sceptical, they're largely disillusioned, and they're being blitzed all day by marketing hype. What we want to do is raise yourself above that cloud level, get your head and shoulders up above the fog, and position yourself in a way where you can build a credible, motivating and trustworthy foothold in the mind of the public. You follow that?
Mm-hmm.
Now, quick question. What are Volvos famous for?
Bad drivers. And lights is the only thing.
That's very true. And also safety.
Okay.
Hopefully somewhere on that list you were going to
actually
say
the cardiologist and the Volvo. And myself, no, not say it.
Let's just move on.
Okay.
A small Swedish company has made a worldwide position from specialising in cars that are renowned and are known to be safe and secure and will protect you.
Okay.
Let me give you another example, which hopefully will be nothing to do with cardiology. Häagen-Dazs ice cream.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Do you like it?
Yeah.
What's so special about Häagen-Dazs?
It's texture in your mouth.
Indeed.
It comes in nice fancy packaging. And it's associated with.
I can see there's two different sides of this entire discussion tonight. But
no,
certainly,
but it is though, Häagen-Dazs.
Move on. Yeah. It's certainly a premium ice cream in the ice cream world. It's the king of ice cream.
Sex sells.
We'll get to that later. It's also more expensive, yet people are willing to pay for it.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, your positioning also determines how much you are worth per transaction in the eyes of the client. In other words, your positioning determines how high you can set your fees. That's why it's so important. The bottom line is, the better your positioning, the higher your fee.
Okay.
And equally, the worse your positioning, the lower your fees are going to remain. That's why it's so critical. You can be doing everything you think you need to do from a marketing standpoint, and yet the customers are still not coming in. And quite probably the main reason is your positioning's all wrong. That's why this is critical. Now, because you were working on positioning, if you have it just right, you will be able to raise your fees with very few complaints from clients, because the clients are happy to pay for your expertise and your excellence, and they won't necessarily see it as a price hike. They'll see it as a justifiable fee. Very, very useful. The only way I would suggest to raise your prices without losing customers is to have expert status in their eyes. And even if you do lose some clients, the increased revenue from the clients you've retained will more than make up for any losses you make. So it's a win-win-win. And as your prices go up, so does the lifetime value of your customer. Just to remind people about lifetime value is how much your client is worth over the lifetime of their relationship with you. So it's how much do they spend each time they work with you, how often do they work with you, and how many times is that client going to work with you over that relationship with you. That's the best way to look at a client and what the client's worth. If your positioning is good, your prices can go up, the lifetime value of your client can go up as well. So overall, what you have is a very high-level abstract concept, which, as a lot of people already know, determines an awful lot of the small details below it. The power isn't going abstract. So we're going to show you how this abstraction works, and then we're going to get really, really specific with how you implement it. Another reason why positioning is so important is because it determines how easy or how hard it is for you to get clients and for you to keep clients. If your positioning is all wrong, if you're an also-ran, if you're just another one of the people who does what you do, then you're going to have the same percentage split of the market as all the rest of them do. So everybody's scraping the bottom of the barrel looking for customers and struggling. If, on the other hand, your position is the person to come to, you have the lion's share. Yeah? And I'm sure you know which way you like it to be. And ultimately, your positioning controls how hard you'll have to work to grow and maintain a thriving business of any sort. Because when customers seek you out and come to you, there is very little, if any, buying resistance to your message. They perceive you to be better educated, more knowledgeable, more experienced, more trustworthy, and more expert at what you do. Thus, they'll happily pay you more money than they would a generalist in the same field that you're in.
Okay.
You follow that?
Yeah.
Now, getting back to this fog of communication, every year the fog gets thicker, you know. According to a quick search I did on the web, apparently in the States right now, there are 30,000 books published every year, on average. Now, that would take you, if you're an average reader, it would take you 17 years of reading, 24 hours a day, just to finish last year's load. There's no way you can possibly keep up with the information. Now, I remember being at school, and I remember somebody telling me that information doubles every year and a half. So every 18 months, the amount of information coming at you is doubling. Now, if you think about, we're in our late 30s, shall we say. okay. Certainly, I remember a time where there were no mobile phones. There was no internet. There was no email. None of these things existed when I was a kid.
12 years ago?
Didn't exist. Now, I see it's interesting when I do in-house work, I'm working with corporations or whatever, on the breaks in my training course, they all run to their desks to handle their emails. Because if they don't, they're going to be completely overwhelmed by the time the course finishes. There's very much a corporate culture with email. The strange curse of email is that if I email you, you now feel compelled to respond to me. And because you've now emailed me, I now feel compelled to respond to you.
Same with text messages.
So we end up in this complete, you know, sargossic sea of messages and information coming at us, most of which isn't actually relevant. Now, there's TV, there's radio, there's billboards, there's newspapers, there's the net, there's email, there's forums, there's YouTube, there's magazines, there's adverts on taxis, buses, trains, planes. Even the human body has become a walking billboard. If you've got Adidas, Nike, SC UK, Versace, obviously in your case, Versace.
Mm-hmm.
So, positioning. This is why it's so important. Now, positioning is not about your product, your service, or your treatment. It's not about what you offer. It's about what your product, service, or treatment does in the mind of the prospect. Don't think sender, think receiver. You position your product, service, or treatment in their mind. It's all about how you're viewed by your clients and customers. It's not what you want to send out, it's what you want them to receive, which is slightly different.
It's how you dress it.
It's the perception.
Relationship.
It is that, and it's a lot more. Are you a professional in their perception? How do they see you? You're looking at you through their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
That's what positioning is about. What in NLP terms is called second position. You float into their body and look back at you and see how you look in their perception.
I find myself doing that regularly.
Yeah. As a film person, you probably would.
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't. Most people tend to stay in their own head, mm-hmm. which is why this is a bit of a stretch.
But everyone sees everybody differently.
That's true.
Yeah.
But they'll see it in their perception.
Would you think that's fair if I was to say that and I was to hear myself saying that? Or is that, does that work for me?
I say that's perfectly fair. You will have your position and your map of the world and your map of reality, and you'll assume that's normal, and you'll assume everyone else is the same one. And that's the interesting distinction, because no two maps of the world are the same at all. We want people to view you in their map of the world as a specialist, not a generalist.
Okay.
There's no phrase that says you can't be all things to all people. You certainly can't be all things to all people and still have a powerful position. So it's worth your time and your effort to achieve expert specialist status in the eyes of your prospects. Now, there's a couple of ways to do that, because the question is, how on earth do you do that? The first way to do it, and the easiest way to do it, is to be the first. The easiest way to do it, to get into someone's mind, is to be the first. So by example, who is the first person to walk on the moon? If we ever did, by the way, but that's an entirely different audio recording. Who was the first person to walk on the moon?
I thought it was Neil Armstrong.
Everybody says Neil Armstrong.
It was somebody else. I can't remember his name.
Well, who was the second person?
He's one of his family members. He thought, that's good, I want to do that.
The Super Dragon. Who knows who it was? But no one knows. That's the point. Everyone knows the first, no one's the second. What's the name of the highest mountain in the world?
Everest.
Everest in the Himalayas. What's the name of the second highest mountain?
Wee Everest.
Baby Everest. Mini Everest. What's the biggest selling book ever published?
Bible.
What's the second biggest book ever published?
New Testament. The Old Testament.
Celestine Prophecy. What was the name of the first person you ever made love with?
God, it was 2008. actually don't remember. That.
Who was the second?
Yeah, slightly better than the first, actually.
Oh no! You ever seen Jaws 2?
Yes.
Superman 2.
Yes.
Rambo 2.
Yes, but I can't remember it.
Never as good as the first movie, in the public's opinion, usually. Pardon me, Aliens. Aliens was pretty good compared to Alien. But I mean, usually the sequels are never as good. Secondly, the sequels are never as profitable. Very, 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 very rarely are they actually more profitable than the original movie. Mm. First is always easiest. The person in first position is always going to be hard to dislodge from your memory. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a law in memory called the law of primacy and recency, which means that you always remember the first thing that happens and you always remember the last thing that happens. The stuff in the middle is usually a bit vague. So after people listen to this audio, they'll pretty much remember how it started. They'll remember the cardiologist. And they'll remember how it ends, however it ends. But the bit in the middle, steady, the bit in the middle...
I love the bit in the middle.
Oh no.
Carry on.
The bit in the middle, thank you, I'm glad I've got your permission. The bit in the middle...
13, by the way, sorry, remember.
It's going to be a bit vague. So primacy is key, you have to be first. Now, the problem is, you may not be first, the chances are someone's already beaten you to it. Brand loyalty for the product or service is built in the same way as you build loyalty in a relationship, Brian. You get there first, and then you be careful not to give them a reason to switch.
Okay.
So, by way of example of how powerful being first is, what do you use, and I'm scared to ask this question, what do you use to suck dust up off your carpet? Serious answer, please. Serious answer, please. A Hoover. No, you don't. You use a vacuum cleaner. Hoover's a brand name.
Right.
Hoover's the name of a company.
Oh.
It's not an implement or an appliance.
I still use a Hoover.
You do use it. You maybe do. You
it's
maybe
an antique.
One. Some people use a Dyson. But again, that's a brand name. It's mm-hmm. not the object
it's
itself.
It's not the object, okay.
Yeah? How often have you ever grabbed a Kleenex?
Oh, I can't afford them. I got you there.
But it's a tissue. It's a paper handkerchief.
Okay.
Yeah? Kleenex is a brand name. Have you ever Xeroxed a document to somebody? Or for somebody?
Oh, no.
Well, Xerox, again, is a company. Yeah, you photocopy stuff or you fax stuff.
Yeah.
Xerox is a brand name.
Mm-hmm.
Think about it. How many of these words have got crept into the English language and people now call them objects? They're nouns. They're not. They're brand names. It's
association.
Advertising. Association. Positioning.
Positioning.
If you're not first, then you're going to have to position yourself on the ladder second or third.
Okay.
Now, the human mind, interesting enough, can only recall consciously between 5 and 9 things. Famous study, George Miller, the magic number 7 ±2. The average person can handle between 5 and 9 things consciously. So ideally, where do you want to be on the ladder?
Right up at the top.
Exactly. You want to be somewhere within the first 5. You do not want to be down near the number 9. Definitely. Now, the only way to score that highly is to concentrate on a narrow target and laser focus on it. Because the mind deletes, distorts and generalises about 2 million bits of information per second. It rejects and screens out most of what is offered to you. And generally, it only accepts that which matches prior knowledge and experience. This is really, really important. I'll say that again. In general, your mind screens out and rejects most of the noise, and it accepts only that which matches prior knowledge and experience. Now, none of what people perceive about a specialist may actually be true, but it is how they perceive you. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Perception is reality. You may want to write that phrase down. Perception is reality. So, as we gently introduce you to this whole idea, let's give you some ways to create an ideal positioning for your enterprise. A few questions that you might want to start to answer to loosen up your positioning muscles. Question number one, what is your business's current position in the eyes of your prospects right now? So let's do this. Can we do this live?
Yeah, sure.
We're sitting here right now in your recording studio.
Yes.
You're part of a company called?
Dabhan Films.
And what do you do?
We offer media services, video editing, audio editing.
Fantastic. Now, what's your business's current position in the eyes of the prospect of the public's marketplace right now? How do you think they perceive you?
Well, we don't aim to be as big as we could be if we were to adopt these principles.
Okay.
This is for survival.
Okay.
Primarily to support other ambitions that we have So it's, even though we're passionate about what we do, even though we're highly proficient, we don't aim to be anything more than that, because it's supportive of our other ambitions. Yeah, it means to an end, absolutely. Financially.
Would you object if it got bigger?
Then, no.
Okay.
But probably not much bigger, because then there would be more responsibility and more time to try and find people that we would trust to take over our position. Okay. Well, to manage what we are currently managing.
But it might encroach and negatively impact the others.
It might infringe and it might affect the work. So that's kind of why I'd like to stay at the hub of seeing everything and verifying everything that goes out the door.
Okay, so you're taking your hands on.
Yeah.
So from the public's point of view, or for your, I mean, who would your clients be then? Give me, what's your ideal client?
Ideal client is someone who is looking for, say, very specific video editing. Corporate, we have currently have about five regular clients that come to us, know the work that we can do, because we put out a showreel to them. We update it every 6 months, with their permission. And so it's word of mouth, mm-hmm. really.
And what do they ask you to do? They're looking for...
They're looking to be in on the work, because they know that we can deliver. They just need to be there to be specific. And we offer about our service that I don't think a lot of other people do, that I know they've been to and other people have been to, is that we can tailor design with them there. But some people don't like that. They think it's infringing on the creative process of what they're doing. We let them sit in with us, and we're still... We can get what it is that they want and articulate. We can help them articulate their ideas more clearly and even come out with better ideas. So it's a collaborative
synergy.
Yeah.
Synergy. What would the finished product be? Would it be a promotional?
Distribution to high schools and things like training videos, health and safety videos, archiving. Things. I've got some footage on various formats like VHS, and they wanted it duplicated and archived that can be put on a loop, maybe in the workplace, or presentations and things as well. Interviews, logging, cataloguing, and distribution of that to their, like the council and things like that, mm-hmm. approaches and asks us to do, mm-hmm. Like fireworks, safety mm-hmm. videos.
Okay, great.
So these things come up for the council, or against racism.
Right.
And these things they take footage from old archives and they bring them to us. We edit them, put them together. We occasionally put voiceovers to it. And we have a few suggestions about how this might be better put across. And we can bring people in to do that. And they get a better dressed product than if they just maybe, they're not collaborated on their work.
Mm-hmm.
So it gets distributed throughout high schools. It's an educational resource. It's resources for the council because they have a remit. Like fireworks, as I was saying, fireworks, anti-bullying, and then these things get like dramatised. There's a script written, and then there's maybe a scenario, like Crime Watch, basically the reconstructions.
This is what I was going to ask.
Educate the kids.
Great, that you just answered my question, because I was going to ask you, from a complete newbie, novice person coming off the street who don't know anything about what you do.
Mm-hmm.
If I was to ask you the question, what is that? What is that like? What do you do? How do we link what you do to something they already know about, so we can get a metaphor or a simile? Well, what we do is like. So you say Crime Watch.
Yeah.
So in that respect, how is it like Crime Watch?
If you can imagine a reconstruction in Crime Watch, they have their own ideas of how they want their business promoted or their ideas promoted, health and safety within the workplace, proper fire regulations, DVDs. So when someone joins the company, they have all this without having to bring staff in to do the training.
Got you.
We produce a DVD that says this is the kind of workplace that you're coming into. These are the people. These are the fire exits. These are the staff regulations. This is a map of the building. All on a DVD, so it's like an initiation DVD.
That's what I'm looking for. It's like an initiation. It sort of makes me think of computer-based training. In a way, a lot of companies sit there and sit you at a PC, and you can learn by sitting there typing a keyboard.
Yeah.
There's a lot more dynamic than that, a lot more visual than that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But okay. So the first thing is to ask yourself, in the minds of the general public, what's your position right now? Are you completely unknown, or are you somewhere on the horizon? Are you somewhere on that ladder, or can you relate it to something they already know about? Can you link what you do as being similar to something that they already understand?
Right.
Okay. So if you say, well, it's quantum physics, and they go, A, you say, yeah, well, it's kind of like a sandwich. There's two slices of bread and there's some meat in the middle. And they go, oh, it's like a sandwich. Right, now I know what you're talking about. But the minute you can link something to something else, people learn quickly.
Like metaphor.
Metaphor, simile, all these kind of things. Exactly. So that's the first thing you want to think about in your prospect mind. Second thing you want to think about is, what position do you want to own in the minds of your prospects? Where would you like to be? So let me throw that one out to you.
The personal thing. Mm-hmm. Where we would like to be in the mind of our prospects, we'd like to be the first person that they come to.
Would you like to be the recognised media company for Glasgow business?
We don't aspire to be that. These are mainly sort of tools of it. So you maybe not pick the best subject because it's only supportive of our ambitions.
I'm determined to kindle your inspiration.
No, reputation is a thing, because mm-hmm. we remain proactive. We mass produce a lot of our own material for ourselves. So we've got the good thing about what we do is we can promote ourselves with
yes.
our resources.
Yeah.
And not because we can visually, we kind of adopt a certain style, there's a certain way that something is put together. It's kind of, I don't know if it's like branding or something, but you can tell that it's a
dab hand
production.
See, that's exactly, again, that's part of positioning. You mentioned reputation, which mm-hmm. is a huge part of positioning.
Yeah.
And secondly, style. You have a recognisable, almost corporate livery, corporate kind of identity.
We have the little twirling hands that look like someone who's setting up a shot, one hand over the other, the typical film directors.
Yeah, they kind of pose.
Yeah, they kind of pose, and it comes twirling in, it's quite fancy, and there's a lot of sound in there that supports the images on the screen, so it's, and that's it. So being a dab hand at something is quite competent.
Absolutely, so. I like that. And you are more than that.
You think so?
If I may say so.
I will.
Based on what I've seen so far, which is why you're here.
And you're one of our very good clients.
Thank you, sir. Now, third thing I want you to think about is, well, also, on that point though, you've raised a really good point. A lot of companies, and you get lots of emails, spam emails coming into your inbox about this, a lot of companies will spend a lot of money on branding, and on the corporate livery, and on a kind of specialist theme, or colour schemes, or whatever, or logos. Now, the problem with that, unless you're Coca-Cola, or you're a very big company who can afford to throw millions of that kind of stuff, and build a brand awareness, the only way you're going to build brand awareness is by repeatedly hitting the public with that message on every medium available. That takes a massive advertising budget. For the kind of people I'm probably going to be dealing with, who are running their own businesses, that's not an option. And in my opinion, brand awareness is a very long, hard slog, and it takes a long, long time to achieve, and it can easily be knocked out. What we're talking about is not brand awareness. I want us to make this really, really clear. What we're talking about is positioning. Now, positioning, you may have a brand, you may have a logo, you may have a visual style that you want to link to, but that visual style and link will become an anchor, it will become a trigger, which is associated to the good feelings that they have about you because of your positioning. So it means that because you're well positioned, you've got a great reputation, and you're known to be a specialist, they have a positive emotional experience with you. While they're having that positive emotional experience with you, they're exposed to your branding and your symbolism and your logos, etc. What happens is the two get linked. So at a later date, every time they now see your logo, they fire off at the memory level that emotional connection with you. That will build far better brand awareness than just designing a fancy logo and splatting it on every cinema screen in the country. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because you may not have a positive emotional association with the company whose brand's up there on the screen.
Okay.
So it's a kind of reverse process, but we'll come to that later. Third question I'd get you to think about as you warm up your muscles is, who do you want to outgun? Now, in your example, you've got a sort of ceiling that you want to stay at, or you've got a kind of level that you're happy staying at, because if you expand any further, it may start to encroach on your other projects and stuff, which is fine. But imagine you have somebody who's really ambitious, really wants to set the heather on fire and run with this thing. They may decide to go head-to-head with the big names. So they might think, right, who's the big white chief in my current industry right now? Well, let's have a pop at him. My advice would generally be, don't bother. My advice would generally be, give that a body swerve.
Right.
Yeah, because trying to gain a foothold, forget going head-to-head with the big names is my overall advice. If you're going to try and find a foothold that's already occupied, you're then standing on the top of a ledge in the mountain somewhere in the Himalayas, and you're trying to out-punch this person. And that, again, is probably not a good idea. Usually requires a big advertising budget, and it's not respecting everybody else's model of the world. Far better is to find a foothold that no one else is standing on.
How do you do that?
We're going to give you a number of ways to do that. One of the best ways to do that is to try and find a weakness in the other person's positioning.
And advertise that?
And advertise that. Which we'll get to
Okay.
We'll get to that in a minute or two. Remaining ethical and remaining legal. However, there's usually a hole in the other person's marketing campaign.
Like the whole war between PC and Mac, have you seen it?
That's the one. And there's another one between, right now live, and we're about to date the CDs, is Sky TV and Virgin. Right. I don't know if you've heard that right now, all the subscribers to Sky are not able to watch Sky 1 and Sky 2, because at the moment there's a little bit of a hostile takeover happening. So there's numerous Sky people who are not happy at this very moment in time. So, interesting situation that's going on right now. So rather than try and box with whoever's already in the head honcho position, I would suggest you don't do that. You find a foothold that they don't have, find another ledge on the same mountain that they haven't occupied yet, or find a weak point in their current ledge and exploit it.
Right.
We're going to give you specific...
How do you do that legally?
We're going to show you how to do that in a minute or two. And you'd be surprised at some of the examples that have legally been done. Number four, money. Money, money, money.
Mm-hmm.
It takes money to build a position. Regardless of how big, small, or how... no matter what scale you want to make your positioning on, it's still going to take you an amount of money. It also takes money to hold on to your position. Because positioning is not a one-time deal. Once you've built a position, you have to retain it and you have to hold on to it, because other people are going to try and knock you off your ledge.
Mm.
So it's very, very important that you have enough money to, first of all, create your position, and secondly, hold on to it and fight off any, contenders. Now, the answer to that one is you can do it, first of all, geographically. So rather than try and be the market number one leader in the whole world, just be the market number one leader in your locale. So it could be, an example I like to use is, you know, Glasgow's recognised pet masseur, for instance. Now suddenly you're positioned within your locality, if you're in Glasgow, as the person to go to in that industry. Another way you can do it is demographically. So you could be Glasgow's recognised infant masseur. So you are niching your target market in terms of age range, and become a specialist within that. So there's always ways to do this.
Okay, yes.
Just requires a little bit of lateral thinking. But it's going to take money to create that, and it may only be a couple of £100 to do your letterheads and your logo on your website. It may be a lot more than that, depends how much you want to spend. We're going to talk about how to do it inexpensively in a moment or two. Number five, on the time issue, can you last the distance? Can you stick it out? Once you've got your positioning, the longer you hold that position, the better your position gets. There's an interesting cumulative snowball effect. So you never ever change a winning formula once you find it. The tactics might change in terms of your marketing and your strategies and the way you get business in, but the long-term positioning strategy should remain stable. So what you do is you ready, fire, aim, you get something out there, you work on it, you hone it, you buff it up, you polish it, and you constantly keep it fresh, but you keep it. I'll give you an example of where this didn't work. And if he listens to the CDs, thanks for listening. Eddie Murphy. Have you ever seen Eddie Murphy's Raw concert when he was a young black guy?
I always wanted to see it.
Okay, it's hysterically funny. It's full of profanity. And it's renowned in comedy circles for what it is. But certainly what you've got is a young maverick, young guy who's out there to take the world by storm, and he's playing on his ethnic background, and he's playing on his humour and his language, and he became quite strongly positioned. As a direct result of that, he obtained the role in the film called 48 Hours. And again, same role. You've got the young black maverick guy who's going to go against the trend, and he's going to buck the system, and he's going to rebel. Now compare that to Flubber. Same actor, entirely different position. Now interestingly, if you look at Eddie Murphy's position within Hollywood circles, his popularity plummeted when he suddenly went into family-friendly movies. He went from being this really risky young buck that, you know, you have to stay in and watch your kids with when they watch the videos, to being a family-friendly, kind of sugar-coated, cheesy kind of character. Now, what he did there was he altered his positioning dramatically and in many ways diluted it. There's no way Eddie Murphy can now recoup that original position and regain it, because forevermore in people's heads, he's going to be known to be the...
bad Flubber guy, but...
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So his position was great, and then he changed it. Now, that often comes about because companies decide to go horizontal and they decide to spread out rather than going vertical and maintaining the high position. Does that make sense? Yeah. The kind of branching out into other avenues, or opening up the brand into other products and services. What you're also doing is diluting your positioning. It's a very dangerous thing to do. You follow that? So, your real life example.
I can see what you're saying, because Well, there you go. You've got Eddie Murphy, who's known for being this kind of maverick off the wall, hysterical, fast talking black man. And then he has turns his hand at comedy, but it was very different for Tom Hanks, because he started out doing comedy, and then he went serious, and he did like The Green Mile.
Yeah.
You know, Forrest Gump was kind of light-hearted, but it was still a serious theme.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he was incredibly well accepted in making that transition from comedy to drama.
Mm-hmm.
But he did it convincingly. Mm-hmm. He made good choices with mm-hmm. the material and with mm-hmm. the directors. Like, probably having control over, well, if this turns out to be not what I think the kind of light I want to be seen in, then pull the plug.
And you're exactly right, and that's really, really important. Once you have your positioning set up, you must let nothing ever damage or dilute it. Nothing must ever leave your office. Nothing must ever leave your mouth. Nothing must ever leave your email inbox, outbox, I should say, that in any way dents your current positioning. It has to be consistent. It has to be congruent.
It's like what I was saying earlier on about not wanting to move up.
Yep.
Not wanting to branch out, or even you know, to in any way, because I cannot let anything leave that door unless it's got my seal of approval on it.
Great.
And it's not because I don't trust anyone, it's just that maybe I haven't got time to invest in expanding
mm-hmm.
when I have other ambitions that are more than that. Mm-hmm. This is supportive of my ambition.
Mm-hmm.
But I still enjoy it, but I just don't want it to leave these doors.
Right.
That's when someone comes to me and says, could you, like what's happening just now, could you maybe do 4 days work on this? And I'll say, well, unless I see what it is I'm actually dealing with, the quality of the material, because eventually I'm going to have to put my name to it, and we all want to put our names to something that is going to be of a quality, the kind of light that we would like to be seen in.
And it's going to outlast you.
Yeah, exactly. Even if it's a well-paid job, it's like 3 days' work will probably do this. Here's £1,000 for 3 days' work. And it's like, well, it might turn out to be five to get it looking far better than what it would be with 3 days. So I have occasionally fallen into the trap where I've committed to say, I need the money.
Yep.
We'd like the business.
Yep.
We'll take the business. We'll do 3 days' work on it, and then say, do you know what? This needs another 3 days to get it the way that I want it and I need it
yep.
for our reputation and our
position.
Because somebody else might just let it go, because for someone else it might just be, that's pretty good.
Yep.
It's not bad.
Yep.
There's gaps there. The sound's not great, but to make it sound perfect, and make it look in the way that, you know, to change the images, manipulate images in a certain way, I'd have to be holding the reins, saying, right, no, we're going to run a track one more time. You know, that kind of thing. So,
In 3 years' time, someone might look at an inferior product that you put out because mm-hmm. you need the money you need at the time, or the people you were working with didn't want to invest the extra 3 days.
Yep.
Your position is now improved, because with time your positioning gets stronger.
Mm-hmm.
And someone then goes, oh, yeah, they made this piece of rubbish. You know, mm-hmm. it's now dense your positioning because mm-hmm. you let it slip. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah.
How many Hollywood
catch it up with you.
How many Hollywood celebrities have been caught out by something they did 20 years earlier?
Oh, I still remember the Hugh Grant stuff,
yep.
don't you?
Exactly.
And
exactly. Not, well, he certainly has a position, but it's not the position he was looking for.
Exactly.
So, let's move on. Now, also,
the Sunbury State.
Exactly. Sixth thing to think about is, what are some of the buzzwords in your industry? What are some of the key search terms? What are some of the languages, or sentence structures, or key phrases that the public and the prospects use? Because words are triggers for associations in people's minds. Words are some of the most powerful anchors in the world. So again, you might want to think about, when you're positioning, what are some of the buzzwords that people out there are looking for, and how can you link them to what you do? It's interesting you use dab hand.
Yeah.
Yeah, the phrase dab hand. You've also linked it to that stereotypical capturing the frame using your thumb and finger.
Yeah.
That makes perfect sense. That works very, very well. It's a tight concept, mm-hmm. you know, it's a tight brand.
Have you seen our business cards?
I don't think I have.
There's not even a phone number or email address or nothing on it.
Even better.
It's just like, it's like, that's a product.
Yeah.
So what you see there, is the Dab Hand logo associated with, you don't need to research it, you just know it's Dab Hand.
I like that.
Well, you told me that one.
Well, my business cards just have my name on them.
Right.
Nothing else.
Okay.
Not even a phone number. But what happens if someone wants my phone number, I'll bring up my nicest fountain pen and I will write my phone number and say, please call me about our discussion on such and such. Here's my number, and I hand it to them. They then remember that. Think about Richard Branson's business card. It probably doesn't say Richard Branson, CEO of Virgin, and then a whole bunch of phone numbers.
Mm.
He probably doesn't even have a business card because he doesn't need one. He's got a funny jumper. So, positioning. Now, let's get into some specific, that's the theory, let's get into some specific strategies for how you actually do this stuff.
Okay.
And I think I've got about 8 or 9 here for you. The first one, it's a visual strategy, so I'll try and do this and think in pictures as we talk about this. Switch to visual mode here. The first one is to draw a very, very simple graph, 2-axis graph, a horizontal line and a vertical line, and what you have are 4 quadrants on your page. Now, what I want you to think about are, what are some of the variables that people look at when they hire someone in your field? So, for instance, in your field, Brian,
mm-hmm.
what are some of the variables? There'll be price, there'll be number of days of shooting, there would be turnaround time,
yep.
travel time, I don't know, what range of products?
Mm-hmm.
What would be the kind of, what are some of the variables? What are some factors?
Like for like filming things,
yes.
it could be shooting format.
Right.
What was it? Is it going to be high definition? Is it going to be just standard digital? The quality of the finished picture.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, it takes an enthusiast to say, "Oh well, as long as it just kind of, you know." Basically, you're dressing it up. Look, this would be the deluxe package, which is high definition, DVD, printed design. You would have glossy covers. Your glossy design, as opposed to matte or something, that makes it look slightly more richer.
Mm-hmm.
Someone approached me and asked me to do like a wedding video. Do you want the pre-wedding chat? So you go round all of the family members before the big day and have a surprise message.
Okay.
So you go round like I did something like that. Maybe for someone's 21st birthday, I was asked to do something. Would you just want to film a party? And I says, well, look, how many? Well, there's lots in the film. Maybe about 15 or 20. I says, well, why don't you go round them all? About, we could start a month before and go around and get like a soundbite.
Yeah.
A little thing that personalises the family member with the person who's, you know, the person whose birthday it's going to be.
Fantastic.
Just about 10-second message. And all this is sort of like edited before the night.
Mm-hmm.
So you could, you're gathering and you can show that on the night and then you film the party. And then she watches what you filmed at the party and then you give them the party later on with that. It's just a bonus thing.
Fantastic.
So what you're doing is you're kind of, there's things like that you can do. Always think maybe 2 or 3 weeks before the thing, how you can bring other things into
mm-hmm.
it. But in terms of specifics, it might be everything down to the way the images look, how it's packaged, how it's boxed, the quality of it. If, do you want it, then you start talking about the style, like slick.
Mm-hmm.
is a word mm-hmm. that is described our work because it's tight, there's
mm-hmm.
maybe rapid cuts in there.
Mm-hmm.
The shooting style,
mm-hmm.
do you want it locked off static, like you're looking at a picture through a window?
Or moving around?
Moving around, roaming around, capturing the physicality of the hands and the eyes and reactions. So what you try and do is you try and match the material with the concept and the emotional side of it.
Excellent.
Like that sort of thing. What is this saying emotionally about where you're going? Where do you want to do that?
Okay.
That's good. Do you want to shoot close up? Do you want to shoot wide shots? That's it kind of varies.
So, okay, so there's a whole bunch of factors and somebody might be hiring you and you're going to run through these factors one at a time and sort of agree to them and then you put the whole thing together. In my industry, running training courses, another example would be there'd be number of days of training at a time. There would be price, there would be guarantees, there would be bonuses, there would be follow-up coaching, there would be whatever. These are all different variables. What you do with this graph is you pick two of the variables. So you might take, for instance, price versus type of film. Is it going to be just digital? Is it going to be high def? What is it?
Mm-hmm.
So your horizontal axis might be price, the vertical axis might be quality of film. And you have these axes from low to high. So it might be low price, really, really cheap end of the market, to really high end of the market. And on the vertical axis, you might have very, very basic filming medium, right up to very, very top spec medium. Then what you do is you find other people in your field who you might call competition. You might feel other people in your industry right now who are currently offering what you offer. And you plot them on this graph. So what you're looking for is, okay, maybe somebody does digital stuff. And it's very, very cheap. So you locate that in one corner of your graph. You might get people who offer digital stuff, but it's very, very expensive. They would be in a different quadrant in the graph. And just find as many people as you possibly can who are in industry right now, especially in your local geography, and plot them on this graph. And you should end up with quite a busy kind of chart. What you're looking for is somebody, or what you're looking for actually is a space on that chart where there isn't anybody. What you're maybe looking for is a one quadrant on that graph where there isn't anyone currently in that sector. You then become master of that sector. You don't have any competition. You dominate your industry because you are the one person who supplies that particular combination of those two variables. So, for example, the example I've got in front of me here is number of days training from 1 day up to 21 days, price from £100 to £2,500. There's numerous companies running 7 day courses, anywhere from £500 to £2,500. But on this graph, there was no one, for instance, offering a 14 day course for £500. Nobody. 14 days, most training companies would not charge at such a low price as £500. If you did, you would be the only person doing that, and I bet you, you would get an awful lot of clients. Now, you obviously might want to have that as an introductory level, and then you may want to have a more expensive seminar later on. But you'd be standing out a mile, and people are going to flock to you because they're going to go, wait a minute, everyone else I can find on the internet is charging £2,500 for 14 days. This group's charging £500. That stands you out.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Well, would people not immediately associate, well, £500 for 2 weeks, and I get 2 weeks with yourself, and then £1,000 for 2 weeks. I'm going to go with a cheaper option.
Some people do, but remember, if you pay peanuts, you often get monkeys. What's interesting is cheaper doesn't necessarily mean better. Also, equally, most expensive doesn't necessarily mean better either. But it is about perception. Now, what I find particularly interesting in this industry is one of the most successful coaching companies currently at the moment is called the Coaching Academy. Very prolific marketers. One of the things they do is a 2-day coaching training. Nothing unusual there. But their 2-day coaching training is completely free. And because it's completely free, they fill the room consistently. Because they fill the room consistently, they have a very large number of clients on their database who subsequently then buy subsequent increased levels of training. It's the classic model of having a free introductory seminar followed by a more expensive seminar later on. That model works. Now, that's just two examples. That's length of time versus price. You could run any two combinations. Any two combinations at all. What you're looking for on this graph is what sector of the map is there no one else in? And consider offering a product, service or treatment using those two variables in that combination because you know you will have no competition. Does that make sense? Now, obviously, it's got to be financially viable, it's got to be ethically viable, it's got to be within your overall business plan, but it enables you to quickly pin down areas where you don't have to find someone on the same foothold as you because there isn't anybody in that foothold.
Okay.
Is that clear?
Yeah.
Need to ask me about that?
No, I'm just trying to relate it to some work that maybe we've done recently. I remember you saying in one of the classes we're recording was that if you're going to price anything, price it by the day, not by the hour.
Mm-hmm.
Is that taking 2 points? So price and time?
Yes.
Is it?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. So that's
interesting. Because I've done that in the past before, and what happened was that I actually done myself out of more money. Because what was supposed to be, okay, I'll do 3 days video editing for £750, which works out at £250 a day. But the problem we actually ran into when the work was it went on a day longer, and I said, well, I said I could probably get this done in 3 days, and then that became a problem because what I said I could done in 3 days took 4, but I couldn't charge any more.
Mm-hmm.
So people always come and say, can you edit this film for £1,000? And I say, well, I have to start asking specifics. They want me to say, yes, I can for £1,000 because they're running on a budget. What they don't come to me and say is, can you give me a quote? They have a certain amount of money.
Yeah.
In their mind, they'll say, okay, I think it'll be about £1,000 to get a short film edited. Okay,
yeah.
It might be, and it might take 5 days,
yeah.
But sometimes it can take 2 weeks if there is more hours of footage to go through. So what I need is more specifics from them. I could edit it if there's maybe 1 hour of footage in 1 day. I'll still charge you, you know, a week's work and make it last that long because I've said, you know, I can get it done in 5 days.
So another quick answer?
What?
If your positioning is good, people won't come to you based on money.
Some people can't afford it.
In which case, they may not be your ideal client. At which point, you now have to decide, do I want to offer them some kind of reduced rate or do I want to refer them on? So part of your positioning is knowing and attracting people who can afford you.
So you're saying I should reject some of the work?
If you can afford to.
Okay, that's different.
Only if you can afford to.
Well, I remember about 2 years ago when we kind of started doing some regular, because you find a lot of, not charities, but a lot of low-budget community projects,
mm-hmm.
Where there is a set budget for the entire thing, and it's all been worked out.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll come maybe, they'll talk to us before the production starts, is can you do this for this, so they can put it in their budget.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know yet, because you've not shot your film, and I don't know whether you've shot 500 hours, it's going to take 500 hours to look through, to make sure we look at everything, to get the best quality job,
mm-hmm.
or it's going to be 5 hours worth of footage.
Mm.
It's going to take 5 hours. You know,
generally what happens is when people are haggling money, or people are talking money with you,
mm-hmm.
they don't have enough other reasons to hire you, so that the only problem, the only thing to up for discussion is money. If your positioning is right, the money discussion very rarely comes up, because there are so many other reasons why they want you as the specialist.
Alright, I get it now. So I should start with giving them Haagen-Dazs. I should pick them up on a Volvo.
Show me your Ferrari.
Okay.
And you've got it.
Alright, okay.
Positioning works and eliminates an awful lot of the price discussions, because they want your specialist knowledge, they want your specialist experience, and they're willing to pay whatever you ask for. That's the point. The minute a client starts haggling price with me, in a way I'm thinking to myself, you've already identified yourself as not my ideal client. Because if you respected and revered my service the way I do, you wouldn't be haggling money with me. Does that make sense?
Hmm.
So you tend to stop attracting those kind of clients because you're positioned too highly for them. Do you want 20 clients each paying you £1,000 a day, or do you want one client paying you £25,000?
Right, personally, just one.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's why positioning is so important. So here's what I'd like people to, who are listening to this, to do, but not if you're driving, is to spend 5-10 minutes putting together some quick graphs. Just get something down on paper, pick two variables in your industry, mark them out on the graph horizontally and vertically. Start thinking about some of the competitors or other people in your field, map them out on the locations in that quadrant, and then look for a space, look for a gap in the market, quite literally. Look for a position that no one else has filled, and spend some time on that. When you've done that, we'll move on to strategy number two.
Strategy number two.
One of the most effective ways of positioning yourself as a leading authority in your field is to publish a report, a white paper, a consumer awareness guide, or even a book. And of all of those, the book is by far the most influential. More than a video, more than an audio cassette, more than a CD, more than a DVD, a book positions you in a very, very strong position. Why? Because there always has been, and there still is today, even with easily made videos and CDs and DVDs, there's something magic about being the author of a book. Now, not an e-book. An e-book was rare maybe 10 years ago. It's not rare anymore. There are ebooks galore flying around the internet for free. An ebook actually can harm your positioning. I'm talking about a perfect bound, published, hard copy, in your hand book. Now, you can publish a book fairly easily. You can write a book fairly easily. Anybody can do it, but they don't. And because of that, there is still an aura of grandeur about being published. Now, if you want to jettison yourself to the top of your industry, I cannot stress enough, write a book. If you think writing a book's out of your reach, it's complete nonsense. If you can write a sentence, you can write a book. Even if your book is only 60 pages in length, the fact that it's perfect bound with a smart jacket will instantly lift you to the dizzy heights of being a published author. Then, when you sell and promote your book to your market, customers instantly see you as an expert in your field. It's perception. Who would you rather talk to in a queue of people? Someone who's an Ulceran or someone who's a published author? Now, am I suggesting you rush together any old unresearched information and throw it together? No, definitely not. But you and I know you're good at what you do. You probably know far more about your particular field than 98% of your customers and clients. All you have to do is to put that information into words, get the intellectual property out of your head, but it's not earning you anything, get it onto paper and put it into a reasonably succinct and interesting, entertaining style, and publish it. Now, I'm a big fan of white papers or free reports or what I call consumer awareness guides. So the 7 secrets to making your DVDs look polished.
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever. Whatever people would be interested in reading. Books are far more useful. Books can actually be made up of several reports put together. If you can write articles, you can write a book. Here's how to write a book automatically, and it's great that we're doing it like this right now. Get together with some friends or clients or the family. Sit around a table. Over dinner is quite a nice way of doing it. Leave a cassette recorder running, or if you've got nice expensive gear like Brian does, wire people up with mics and just talk. Just have a conversation for a few hours in detail about every subject that you can cover about your product and service and expertise. And go deep, don't leave anything out, take questions, because it's the unprepared stuff that's always better. The scripted stuff can sound staid and academic. When you're willing to let it flow, out will come the real juicy stuff. You then give the tapes or CDs to someone who can type it out and transcribe it, preferably in double or triple spacing, and with a little editing and rearranging, you have a book. You add an introduction, you add a conclusion, you then take it to a publisher's, and it's that straightforward. And you'd kick yourself for not doing it. It's unbelievably straightforward. Another method to do it is to come up with 24 main points about your topic, 24 things that you think people ought to know, or 24 things that you think you feel strongly about, and write a short article on each, 1 or 2 or 3 pages on each one. By the time you've finished all those articles, you have a book. That simple.
Do you need someone to edit it?
You can do if you want to, but I'd rather get it out. Just get it out. Print on demand. Get it published. You can always edit it later. Get feedback. Take 100 copies out. Ask the buyers of the book or the owners of the first 100 copies that you've signed as first edition special release issues to then give you feedback, which you'll then incorporate into your second edition. They'll also get a credit, they'll get an acknowledgement at the start of the book, they'll feel involved, they'll feel as if they're contributing, and they do your editing for you.
So you take it to a printer and get it printed. Yep. How do you get to publish it?
There are numerous companies who will publish a book on demand. So you don't have to go through rejection slips, you don't have to keep sending it to people, they will happily check through it. If it's all 100% legal and ethical, and it's all your own copyrighted information and intellectual property, they will publish it for you. How many copies would you like? The company I use is a company called Trafford.com. They're based in Canada and in England, and they have a massive distribution network linking to Amazon and various other Barnes & Noble. That's only one possibility. There are many more. But essentially, you PDF the document, send it to them, you will have a book within about 4 weeks.
So you need the software to do that?
You can get free PDF software. You can actually give it to them, they'll do it for you.
If you did an audio recording of it?
Yep.
Would you be able to give that to them? Would they accept that? Would no?
They would probably rather you did it as a Word document or you had it transcribed.
Well, you could even get like one of your friends as a I'm just thinking here, right?
Hire a student.
Hire someone to type it up, like a secretary who can type 80 words a minute.
Absolutely.
Get them to like put it on when they do memos and stuff like that. They've got the boss's memo and then they type it up. They can do that. Like,
absolutely can do that. A friend of mine that works as a receptionist and a PA in an office, and she does all my work for me. Every time I do a seminar, I record it, she then transcribes it. I have both an audio program and a book. If you're going to talk, talk forever. Nike say just do it, I say just do it once. Stay it, get it out your mouth, but record it, you've then got it forever. Get it transcribed, that'll outlast you by miles.
Okay.
Now, there's a lot more advanced strategies that you can use. But if you write these articles, for instance, you can then submit these articles to newspapers, to e-zines, to magazines. They can become free downloads. They can become consumer guides, booklets, fact sheets, e-courses, and press releases. You can repurpose one piece of written work into many other versions and varieties which will serve you. Now, there's a lot more advanced strategies which I'm currently testing at the moment. I've come across a fantastic way of creating a book and a teleclass and an e-book, all within about a month from beginning to end. It's a very simple, simple process. I'm currently testing it at the moment. If it works, I'll probably publish that in a later audio, so stay tuned for details.
Okay.
But right now, you might want to jot down for 5 minutes, jot down some ideas about articles, things you feel passionate about within your field or industry, things that you think no one else knows, stuff that you feel strongly motivated to talk about. What are some of the things that you find yourself talking about to prospects? What are some of the frequently asked questions that people ask all the time? What are some of the myths or stereotypes in your industry that people perceive as being true that you know aren't and that need to be busted? Spend 5 or 10 minutes thinking of some short ideas. Do that now.
Will we follow some music?
I think that'd be a good idea.
Okay. If you're driving right now, you might enjoy this little number. We'll be right back after the break.
This is off the new album. Positioning strategy number 3 is what some people call the USP, the unique selling proposition or unique selling point, which is very often overdone and badly done. So let's give you a couple of ways of doing this. You have to offer some unique or distinctive advantage above and beyond that of your competition, or the public are going to go elsewhere. I continually meet life coaches or therapists who want to be well positioned in their industry. So they immediately set themselves up, website, brochure, business card, call themselves coach. And the problem with that is you are now the same as every other coach on the planet. You've just positioned yourself as being part of a large group. So you're no longer an individual, and there's no real compelling reason why I should hire you. The analogy I always like to use with people is, imagine this. I'm standing in front of you and there are 5 other coaches by your side. You're a life coach and there are 5 other coaches in the queue. Here's my question. Why should I hire you and not one of the other 5?
Because you drive a Volvo.
And you like hanging that.
Yeah.
Now, the point is, most coaches can't tell me why I should hire them. They just go, well, because I'm trained as a coach. Yep, so are the other 5. Because I will give you good service. Yep, so will the other 5. And you'll tell me exactly the same as what the other 5 are going to tell me. You can't afford to be an also-ran. Part of your positioning is that you can language very carefully and punctually exactly the benefit or the advantage in me hiring you as opposed to anyone else. That is your unique selling point. So here's my question for you. Why should I hire you? Of all the people that I could come to for your product, service or treatment, why should I bring you in? If I want to get a DVD made for my company, why should I hire Dab Hand?
Because we're the best.
Yep, and everyone else will say that. Why else?
Just take a look at a showreel and then make the comparison and decision yourself.
That's better. Any more? Why should customers come to you and not another company?
You want the real reasons?
Yeah.
No, honestly.
You've got some kind of advantage. You have some sort of benefit that no one else offers that you can.
What I was talking about earlier.
Okay.
Which was the, it's a collaborative thing. You come to us with something and we will make it come to fruition. But we have to be very careful because some people will like an idea and take it for themselves and go and get somebody else who's cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll implement that into, I want this, 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 and this, this. Mm-hmm. So what we say is, if you want this to be the best that it can be, then come to us because we will collaborate to make your idea better than it currently is.
Mm-hmm.
Better how? It'll have its own style. Visually. Well, I could give a number of reasons, but it's mainly, it's a collaborative thing. We can custom design something instead of just saying, oh, can you make this, or can you do that? Yes, we can, but we want you to be part of the process too. So we bring them in on the work that we're doing for them.
Okay, so there's an involvement and there's a coalition and there's a synergy between
the creative
departments of both Dab Hand and the client.
You're building a relationship.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. And in fact, you can language that positions you well. Whereas most companies, well, we can do it quite quickly. You know? Yeah. Well, yes. Yeah,
so well, I've been told I'm fast at what I do.
That's useful. That's useful, and you may want to actually use that as part of your positioning.
But also, kind of cut their own throat, because if we're fast at what we do, people expect something done quicker.
That's true.
And not only done quicker, but they still expect top quality. So we have to work faster to achieve the best results.
Possibly, or you follow the policy that I like to teach, which is under-promise and over-deliver. So you cut down, you give yourselves plenty of buffer, and you quote longer turnaround times than you know you're capable of. Yeah. But then you actually deliver quicker than they were expecting.
Yeah.
That then changes the perception. That
well, they can't be in on it then, because they would see it being...
That's true. But again, that's down to an individual, and yeah. In terms of your delivery, you have to be very careful about how you time stuff.
Unless what we can do is we can be part of the pre-production thing, which would probably have a small charge for, like, we offer a service where
we
get all the pre-planning from you,
right.
We get all the... We gather the tools, then we start to trade with them, and we trade in our own time without them present.
Mm.
So we gather ideas from them and say, well, we've got some ideas now, we can make this better. And throw one or two out. I really like that. It's take an hour or so thinking about how can we add a few bells and whistles onto this choir here. Because they just come and it's just like, oh, right, okay, you've brought your choir, right, let's hear them sing. Great. Do you know what would actually make it better? You know, if they were all eating hanging dads. No, but... How to dress what they already come with,
yes. Yeah.
And just one or just a couple of things, and it's just some of it's just unconscious. It just comes right out.
Now here's a question: wouldn't you do that? Would you do that anyway?
No.
So you wouldn't automatically. I wouldn't cross your mind automatically.
Well, the thing is, instinctively, I like to collaborate.
Right.
So it's an instinct for me.
Right.
Because it helps me grow. And it helps my ideas. If they come to me with something, it inspires something for some of my work. It's not stealing. It's being. It's. When you get an idea that has, when you get ideas, it's easier for me to work within an idea than it is to say, just give me something.
Yes. Yeah, obviously.
So
yeah.
Largely it lies in the material that they bring to me or the question that they have. I can answer a question.
Yeah.
So sometimes when it's great to be interviewed is people ask you questions.
Yeah.
You can expand.
Yeah.
It's the same when people bring you the fabric.
Yeah.
You know, you can knit something.
Yeah.
Instead of actually having to be the one that creates the fabric.
Got you.
So it's having something, a template to work from. And so tell me about your project. Why are you doing this project? What is the demographic? So we are, what, maybe a year away from releasing a film? We haven't even shot it yet. We're already thinking demographic, target market, distribution.
Good.
Who, how, where, and what, and when.
Mm-hmm.
Are these films delivered in the past?
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to follow form. That's something that you talk about, but there are certain films made within a similar price, similar budget, that we think, okay, great performance is a prerequisite. Great quality, looking, visuals are a prerequisite. It's the quality of the story that matters.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know we can get great visuals. We know we can get, you know, the making of great performances. These are prerequisites. So before we even start thinking, before the film's out, we're thinking, we know this, we know that, but what... Who's going to see this film when it's out?
Now that's really interesting to see, because what often happens...
You cross genre. It's like a cross between Star Wars and Forrest Gump.
Got you.
So that's a lot of people, but they like that in pitches.
Yeah.
Pick a film, like, it's like...
Link it to something they already know.
Yeah, already know about.
Yep.
You know, it's basically like, the Karate Kid meets... Cinderella or something like that. All right, okay. I'd like to see, well, that's pretty much the same sort of story, really. But you're crossing the genres.
Yep,
something that you can immediately identify with. Like,
I
find myself saying your own words now, right?
Yes.
But that's kind of it. You cross genre.
Got you. Now
identification.
The one of the key things interesting. You said what you said there a minute ago, that there are certain processes and procedures that are your instinct that you'd automatically do or think about doing. Now it's quite possible that other people who do what you do may do that as well, but they may not tell anyone. They may not actually verbalise that that's the thought process they go through.
All right, so you're not showing your whole hand.
Kind of. However, you want to. You absolutely want to. There's a famous story about, I think it was Schlitz Beer, who was struggling to sell much at all in the States a few years ago. So they brought in a marketing consultant, and the famous story is the marketing consultant watched these people drill 200 metres down into the bedrock to find the cleanest spring water. They then watched them grow their own yeast cells and work on the actual production of what's going to create the beer in the first place. They watched them distill the water and purify the water and distill the water and purify the water umpteen times till eventually they had the beer they wanted. And then even then they rejected 2/3 of the bottles that were produced. And the marketing consultant said, you know, why do you make beer like this? Why do you go all this bother with drilling holes and yeast cells did it? And the beer company said, well, all beer companies do it this way. And the marketing consultant said, yeah, but no one tells the public that. And all Schlitzbier needed to do was be the first company to actually tell the public, here's what we do to brew our beer. We drill these holes, we get the spring water, we ferment our own yeast, da da da. And because they were the first people to actually explain that to anybody, because everybody else took it for granted, they got the market share. So very often, to find your unique selling point, if you don't have some immediate advantage or benefit that you can see that no one else offers, ask yourself, what are you already offering that you take for granted that's so obvious to you, it's built in, but it's not obvious to the client? You just need to be the first person to actually offer that and be known for that, and you instantly have a position.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Now, some ways of finding that information out, from some ways of languaging what you do and what makes you different from anyone else. Here's a few questions you may want to ask yourself. Number one, what are you really good at? So let's run this. What are you really good at Nabhan? What are you really good at?
I was thinking about that. I was talking about this today, actually. Being multifaceted.
Mm-hmm.
As in, from a personal point of view or from a company point of view, is very different.
Company point of view.
Nabhan's
really good at?
We're really good at our artwork, our packaging.
Okay.
We're also really good at... small, like this, it's just two people.
Mm-hmm.
We could do the same for 10.
Mm-hmm.
We're very good at accommodating numbers.
Mm-hmm.
We're portable.
Well, okay, that's nice. Portable. That's quite good.
Mm-hmm.
That's quite good. Okay, what are your clients really buying?
They're buying the product that they want.
Nah,
that they come for.
What are they really buying?
Buy me.
Yeah, but what do they want the product for? For what purpose? Why do they want something put onto film or put onto audio? For what purpose?
Vanity.
Really?
Some are. Some have a remit, which is part of their own job to provide.
And what does that give them?
It gives them status within their own work.
Bingo.
Because if they come, because what actually happened is a friend of mine actually was promoted after we had collaborated.
Okay.
I'd met him at some kind of community discussion about children's involvement in their school safety, to do with safety. And I said, oh yeah, blah blah blah. And he asked me, well, what do you do? I said, well, I provide a service which is video editing, such and such. Oh, we might be looking to have something filmed or something put on that, because they're used to delivering pamphlets and leaflets.
Okay.
Thinking, okay, fine. And I guess what I was doing unconsciously was finding out from him how he currently produces what he gives.
Yep.
his bosses.
Yep.
Because councils have remits. Find out what their remit is. They have to produce XXX statistics, XXX, XYZ, images of... We need to be seen doing something that's good in the community. Because that's what the council do.
Absolutely.
You know, they work with the police and the fire brigade and the training and all that sort of thing. So I guess what I was doing was unconsciously finding that out. So he said, I'll talk to you. Give me your ideas. So I sent him an email. And it was like, well, let's try something. So we tried something, which was a 3-minute looping DVD, which was basically what the council do in this department, given to the boss, just to make the boss look good. Oh, I didn't, you know, this is, when anyone asked me what I do, I just showed them this slick little video. And it was like, my boss was really impressed with the light that she was seen in, that she's asked me if I would like to do a bigger project, which is more about more involvement with other people.
Okay.
So we came back with this other project, and we discussed that further. And it involved filming, editing, photography, graphic design, packaging. And then the boss person from the other job got their name on it, produced by. And they think, oh, movies, oh, my name's on this box cover. And
50
all,
minutes of fame.
Yeah, so they're buying their own, like, the vanity, so their own significance was being replicated in this fashion. It was getting seen by all the other people who were, you know, were going to go to see it, like the schools and the people involved.
Fantastic.
So then, listen, it was basically said, would you like to be the manager of the new media services division and work in developing projects with the other departments.
Wow.
So we can show there. And they've been like, I'd like to offer you this promotion. So they ended up earning more money, working less,
yep.
but enjoying what they were doing, and they actually found out what they were really good at.
See, Dab Hand, another successful story.
I've helped promote other people doing
that. Yeah,
yeah. And it still comes to me to this day to get...
That's interesting. So it's about being maybe hero, being significant, being noticed, 50 minutes of fame. What are you really selling, is the third question. What are you really selling?
Really selling? Oh, that's probably a lot of answers to that.
Mm-hmm. Just give me some.
Well, we're really selling what they really want.
Which is?
Product.
For what purpose? That's not what they want product.
They want product. Well, they don't want product for a purpose?
Yeah, they do. They don't want product. They want what the product gives them.
Okay.
Which is what?
I guess an emotional.
Okay. See, now you're getting into it. You have to really think, haven't you? You have to go, okay.
What does it give them emotionally?
Yeah, what do you actually sell people, ultimately? So I had an argument once. I was hired by a woman who wanted to set up a feng shui company in Scotland. And I've been doing feng shui for years, so I was quite happy to be a consultant. And it's interesting, the day I met her, she was having a stand-up row with another woman in the middle of an exhibition centre. And I should have taken that as an omen, because a few years later I was having a stand-up row with her in an exhibition centre. And history repeats. And I remember one of our parting shots was, you know, we're here, we sell a service. And I said, no, we don't. We sell hope. We sell hope that things will improve in the future. That's why people hire feng shui consultants. They want the feng shui consultant to come in to rearrange their furniture in their house and their belongings, because by so doing, their lives are magically going to get better. And we sell that hope. That's what we sell. We don't sell wind chimes. We don't sell fancy paint you put on your walls to make it harmonious. We sell hope that the future is going to improve. And that's why we didn't see eye to eye. And that's really what we were offering. And I think it's really important that you realise that you're not a coach, you're not a therapist, you're not an actor, you're not a producer. You're actually selling something else. And it's that ultimate, what are you really, really selling people?
Is this at the unconscious level?
Most of it will be, because it will be emotional.
So you've got to, well, it's, I guess it's like, in a way, it's like directing.
Mm-hmm.
You have to find out what the emotional obligations are.
Yep.
Where the emotional journey is.
Yep.
And using, well, the book that I'm reading at the moment is a fantastic book. It's all about intuition. How there is no clear set, well, there's tools, but mm-hmm. there's no clear set path. There's mm-hmm. no clear set way of using these tools mm-hmm. to get good results.
Mm-hmm.
The tools are changeable, they're malleable. They're like, it's all about communication, because we'll just talk a little bit about what I've learned. Even, well, I guess I've always known this, but this has become very much a part of where I'm taking my work now, is that the very, maybe half of the amount of people that are directors that I've worked with are only half, reasonably good at half of their job. They don't realise that there's two main factors to their job. They think there's only one. Well,
which are?
Film directors
mm-hmm.
are essentially what? Storytellers.
Okay.
Okay. But they might be reasonably good storytellers, because we get reasonably good television, or we get reasonably good commercials. But what they fail to achieve is the other department, which is communication.
Okay.
How do you communicate with someone using language and using empathy and using story and talking to that, because everyone's model of the world is different.
Mm-hmm.
What you talk about visual, kinesthetic, auditory. Well, you have to find that out. What is it about this person that I can bring into the performance so they own it more? So
right.
It's not like trying to put a square peg in a round hole. You say, give me more anger.
Yeah.
I am not instinctively a very angry person, though, Brian. Right. Well, okay. Then what you do is you start, well, just give me more anger, because anger is like, when there's anger, sadness, fear, guilt, and love.
Yeah.
What you eventually get when you watch a performance is a result of these things. Or you get 50% anger, or 20% love, and 3% fear. It might be a cocktail of these things, but it's how you actually get that without saying, give me more anger, because anger's a combination of things.
So you need to be able to pull that out.
Yeah. By telling stories and saying, it's the kind of anger associated with if someone had
Got you.
Or it's as if.
Yeah.
Like what scene was all about.
Yeah.
It's as if he has his father's funeral in the morning. That's going through your mind. So that you have to find these words and these phrases and these stories to try and inspire that motivation. It's the whole, what's my motivation? Well, your motivation is the kind of fear associated with if you were to, when you were telling me the other day, .. Yeah. It's that.
Right. And you light up their neurology, yeah, and now it's genuine. It's not yeah, enacted, because it's pulling from their core.
Exactly. It's working the unconscious level, so it's superfluous. And the other key thing, I'll just finish here, is that you're talking to them in the kind of mood that you would like the character to be in.
So you're leading them, actually, by example.
Leading them by example, by doing that. I could give you more examples, but you get the picture.
That's interesting. Okay, so we're always back to the emotion. People don't buy on logic, people buy on emotion.
Mm-hmm.
You have to move people emotionally.
Yep.
So how do you climb into people's heads and work out what it is they actually want and what is it you can actually offer them?
Yeah.
Which will always be emotional. A simple question, number four, is why should people buy from you? Now, you need to be able to answer that question. If you haven't got an answer to that question,
okay,
go away and work on it till you do.
I'll tell you, I've seen some people who actually do what I do,
mm-hmm,
and they do reasonably well,
mm-hmm,
and we have similar connections and stuff, and a lot of it is to do with the kind of relationship that you've got with them. Like I say, the chap that I still work with, we are friends,
mm-hmm,
but there's a fine line between, you know, familiarity can be contempt.
Yeah.
You know, we all know that saying, right? But it's beautifully illustrated in when you're working with someone and there's money involved,
mm-hmm,
and there's commitment involved, you have to draw a fine line, and it's in your behaviour, how you set up. Look, you know, we can trust one another, and you know never to mess with me, and I know never to mess with you. You draw that line in your behaviour, in the way that you conversation. And then when you, it's not like you're acting with your friends, you're basically establishing the rules of trust,
mm-hmm,
unconsciously, mm-hmm, so that you can just say, okay, let's get this out of the way, let's lay a safety net. Everything I say to you is not personal. It's all for the better of our relationship and our work.
Yep.
Yeah, let's get that out of the way. There's a safety net. So it's like a 5-minute conversation you have with,
yeah.
Don't you hate it when someone does this? That's the last thing I want in life. Not saying it's the last thing I want from you.
Mm.
It's to establish that,
mm-hmm,
connection, have a connection with them,
mm-hmm,
either on a common interest, but not to be so on the nose with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's to just be honest and just be real, because a large amount of people are afraid of intimacy. They're afraid of honesty because they appear vulnerable. And I could get hurt in this because if I know that I'm in a habit of doing this at this point, and it's happened to me several times. When I've done favours for people, I don't like to use the word favours, I like to use the word assisted someone in doing something as opposed to helping them, because, mm-hmm, I mean, as soon as you start helping someone, you feel as if they owe you, mm-hmm, but if you assist someone, it's like, you know, there's no really any obligation. Okay. That's another thing.
Yep.
But I guess you're selling yourself when you're selling your product.
Absolutely, and you have to be able to tell me why I should be buying your product from you and not somebody else. And if you can't, you're gonna have problems. And see, if you can't conceptualize it, how in the hell are they gonna do it? If you can't visualize it in your head, if you can't language it, there's a great phrase that says, whereof a man cannot think, thereof a man cannot speak. If you can't actually think it in your own head, you can't communicate it to anyone else, therefore they're not gonna think about it, because remember, don't think sender, think receiver. In their head, how could they perceive you if you can't actually perceive yourself?
Yeah.
So ultimately, these questions have got to be answered. What's one good reason why I should hire you? You have to have at least one good reason. Write down a single compelling sentence about why your client should buy from you instead of somebody else. Or ask yourself, what's the single biggest stereotype that your prospects have in your business? When people come to your industry, what kind of preconceptions have they already got in their head that you know is rubbish, but you still have to cut through that fog before you get to the heart of the matter? What do they tend to come with already in their head? I'm a hypnotherapist, so I'll often get, oh, you're going to have me barking like a dog, or I'm going to do the chicken dance, or you know, and I've got to get past that. What are some of the kind of misconceptions that people come automatically with?
Okay, if you're quick, you can't be very good.
Okay.
You're very good at one thing. It doesn't mean you're, because I don't know whether it's just a Scottish thing, or I don't know. But there is this, not general, but limited observation that if you are multifaceted, because we have to be, you know, then you can't be very good at everything.
Okay. Yeah, so somehow it dilutes.
Yeah, okay, I see the BAFTA thing, I see the thing on the wall, that you, okay, you're a good actor, but you can't be that great, and you can't be very great at working with audio. What's audio got to do with that?
Okay, that's interesting. So, first of all, identify what is the stereotype that people come with. Secondly, how can you pop it? How can you burst that? How can you cut the legs from underneath that right up front? What can you do or say or position?
What would I say?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll tell you what, I'll do this for free if you're not impressed. I want a promise from you that you'll pay me double.
If you are. That's an interesting gamble, but I would rather it was a, first of all, I'd rather it was a message that you can impart up front, so you don't even have to have that kind of conversation. It's like multifaceted and excellent in all of them, and that's part of your tagline. It's up front, you know. We handle all of it from pre to post production at exactly the same standard all the way through, or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's immediately communicated. There doesn't be punch and sex up in that, but that's the kind of thrust of what I'm talking about. So you cut that one out of the conversation.
It's great having something that does that for you.
But exactly.
Also, there's another thing that's a good thing to do is to, which is kind of a wee bit sneaky, is to have someone drop your name their way. You know, like maybe to, I'll not divulge too much, but you can basically dress up your own success by having a third party.
Mm-hmm. Always.
You know, boost it for you.
Third party, always credibility, testimonials, absolutely. The minute somebody
buzz about you.
Mentions you, you're now buzzworthy, and I want you because someone else that I trust or respect.
Absolutely. That happens so regularly. Totally. It's like, oh, I've heard, even with some of them we're working on at the moment. I've been looking for this particular person to work on a production, and it was kind of, yeah, well, let me see what it's all about. Let me see what's involved and who's involved in things. And they just happened to know someone who was a friend of mine that I didn't know. Well, hey, such and such is interested, or he told me, what's it all about, what's it all about? And I said, well, you kind of want to be working with this guy. Because while we're here, have you got 20 minutes to watch one of his previous? Go put it on. Well, I'll tell you what, you take it away and watch it. No, let's put it on. So they put it on, and it was like, doesn't even need to say anymore.
Yeah.
Because they had something that obviously impressed them.
Yeah.
And it came from a third party, and it was like, yes, when do you want me?
Yeah, exactly.
So where do you want me to be?
Exactly.
Where do you want me to be instead of like?
Yeah.
Where can we meet?
Yes.
Yeah, it's like, so they're starting.
Or you're coming to me.
Yeah, exactly.
You can get me at.
I'll call you back.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to be needy. And again, another part of positioning is you do not want to look the needy and scarce person. The old phrase that said, bad salesmen have skinny kids. You don't want to be coming across as needy. You want to come across as, do you know what? Whether you do business with me or whether you don't is not really going to matter a jot in my diary. Mm-hmm. You know, and therefore there's none of that kind of hunger behind it. And that's actually more attractive. So, next exercise, quick questions to ask yourself. What are you really good at? What are your clients really buying? What are you really selling? Why should people buy from you? One really good reason. Why should they buy from you and not one of your competitors or somebody else in your same field? What's the single biggest stereotype your prospects have in mind about your business, and how can you bust that stereotype? Spend at least 5 minutes working on that. Do that now. Also,
go on.
On the topic of unique selling points. There's the elevator speech, which is another cliched strategy, but it actually works quite well. The scenario is, if you get on a lift and there's someone else with you on the lift, and they say to you, oh, what do you do for a living? In the time it takes to travel one floor, you should be able to hit them with a sentence that instantly impacts them, touches them emotionally, clearly communicates what you do, but also clearly communicates your positioning as well. That's what's called the elevator speech. Now, there's a couple of ways you can do that. An example would be, you know how, blankety blank, and in there you have common problem or grievance. Well, what I do is, blankety blank, an ideal solution to problem. So an example would be, you know how your driveway gets really dirty and grimy and weeds start to come through the gaps in between your slabs and it spoils the way that your whole house looks? Well, what I do is I can freshen that up and it looks brand new in one afternoon.
Empathy.
Kind of. But it's also instantly communicating a message that anyone can understand. And it's also ideally positioning yourself and your unique selling point in there as well. So in this case, it's speed. We can do it in a day.
So can I ask you just quick while we're on this?
Yep.
So if you, the elevator speech you're talking about.
Yep.
If somebody, you strike up a conversation with someone and then the time you get to the second floor and you're going up 6 floors, So by the time we've actually left the first and second floor and you're talking to them, is to try and find out what they do and strike common ground you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Common ground. And then being quite friendly.
Well, I would say that's all a given. You always want to get rapport. You always want to, rather than you explain what you do, is to climb back into their head and find out a little bit about them so that then you can...
Sometimes, in my experience, some people who are friendly are needy.
Very true. Very true.
How do you overcome that? Is it how you deliver it?
It's what you deliver. It's the content of what you deliver. In the elevator speech...
Ah, okay.
The ideal reaction to an elevator speech is... Wow. That's what you want.
It's a short amount of time you've got impact.
Well, and Brian, they read your name badge. Brian Larkin, what do you do, Brian? Well, do you know how da-da-da-da? Well, what I do is this. And they go, wow, really?
Okay, you've not just spoke about the details of your work. You've basically just hit them with, well, it's like Forrest Gump. I make movies about people like him. Right, I loved that movie.
Yep.
We've loved it too.
And you've got them. And you've impacted them. Now, that will very quickly tell you whether they're a client or a prospect for you or not. But it should wow them, it should impact them, it should also position you greatly. Another example would be, I support type of client, in their desire to, common desire, by, how you do it, So, I support new actors in the desire to build a secure income in the first 3 months of their acting profession. By teaching them marketing strategies that work.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Or I teach new therapists, I support new therapists in their desire to build a secure practice by being profitable in month one. And they go, no. And they go, yes. No way, That's an elevator speech. So you might want to craft something along those lines. You've got a couple of sentence structures to do so. Spend 5 minutes doing that now. Strategy number four. Number four is niche marketing.
Right.
Oh, yes. Pick the various target markets that you would like to attract to your practice or your business. Or pick an area that you have a lot of personal experience in. See, what often people do, people when they set up a business or they set up a new venture, is what they do is they throw out their net and try and catch anything with a pulse. The problem with that is not everybody out there is a target prospect. And by niching, by honing down to a particular type of client or particular problem that you want to work with or a particular demographic or geographic niche, you actually become a specialist far easier because you're only interested in that one facet. You're not interested in everything. Now, people then sometimes go, well, wait a minute. If I pick a particular niche, if I'm going to work with only with teenagers, for instance, doesn't that reduce the number of clients I've got? Well, yes, it does in terms of numbers, but you're going to be seen as a specialist with that type of client. Therefore, the majority of those clients are going to come to you. You'll actually end up making more money. Because again, your position determines how high you can set your fees.
Okay.
Now,
because I'm an actor, mm-hmm, and I'm with Equity, because I'm doing this for you, can I get Equity Minimum?
The other thing you can do, moving on, is you can have as many niches as you want.
Right.
So there's nothing to say you can't have more than one niche. However, you target market the niches individually. So if you were going to position yourself as a life coach to teenagers, all your marketing, all your strategy, all your positioning would be about life coaching to teenagers. But that would be one niche. You may also have a separate niche, which is life coaching for sports people and athletes. All the marketing, all the websites, all the brochures, all the strategy around that niche would be aimed at that niche. Then there's nothing stopping you having both niches. Does that make sense? You just never ever dilute them. Common problem that a lot of adverts do is, well, yeah, buy our raincoats. Our raincoats are great. Our raincoats are made with whale blubber. Our raincoats can withstand tornadoes and hurricanes in New Orleans. But we also sell Wellingtons. Right at the end of the minute, they blow it because they offer some other completely unrelated product that you're actually looking for. And suddenly it wastes it. Suddenly you've now confused the client. You've given the client too many options. And you're talking to two different sets of people. Keep it tight. Have that niche. You only ever market to one niche at a time. If you try to attract them all at one time, you're going to look like a generalist, and the value of your services and the fees that you can charge plummets. Match your message to your niche market. You then position yourself as an expert in that niche, and you stake claim to your expert status. Does that make sense? But you can have more than one niche. So if you think that's going to limit the number of clients you've got, great, have three or four niches. You're going to be a specialist in each of them. So, for example, Glasgow's recognised massage therapist for infants. that may be one niche. You may also have Glasgow's recognised massage therapist for sports injuries as a separate niche, and you cater for both, but you only ever market one position, one approach to that one target market at a time. Follow that? So spend 5 minutes thinking about who are the kind of ideal clients you want to work with, or your particular presenting problems that you're really good at solving that you want to work with. Do you want to specialise in particular phobias or particular health issues? Or what's a demographic type that you want to work with? Or is it a geographic type that you want to work with? And come up with some target areas. It may be public speaking. It may be money worries. It might be animal phobias. Whatever it is, specialise those different areas and come up with maybe 2, 3, 4 different niches. Do that now. Positioning strategy number 5.
Yes, number 5.
Is to conduct seminars, talks, or lectures. Because here's an interesting fact that I heard years ago, and don't tell anyone I told you. People automatically give speakers more credit than they're necessarily due. It's true. The minute you see somebody up on a stage, or behind a lectern, or beside a microphone, in front of a group of people, public speaking, the basic human instinct is to automatically put them on a pedestal. And assume that they must know more than I do, because they're the one that's talking and I'm the one that's sitting down. Mm. So by utilising that, by conducting any kind of talk, seminar, 10-minute speech, keynote speaking, lectures, whatever you want to call them.
Masterclasses,
I do like that title. You suddenly put yourself up there. And public speaking is, I think, number one fear in these rank tables that you always see is spiders. Number two is usually public speaking. Number three is death. Which means that more folk would rather be in the box at a funeral than giving the speech, which is quite bizarre. So because so many people are scared of public speaking, and because people give credit to a speaker automatically, you can use that to position yourself. Not only can you impact more people in a short space of time, you can actually charge them less than you would if you were seeing them one-to-one. So if you're going to do, say, an hour-long presentation, well, you could charge your client £100 for that hour of your time, or you could charge 50 people £50. For an hour of your time. You earn a heck of a lot more money. Uh-huh. It's a win-win-win because they pay less. Yeah. And you can impact way more people in the short space of time. When I first went self-employed, I asked every other NLP consultant I could find at the time, what should I do? You know, what's the quickest and easiest way to get into business and to set myself up? And of the two strategies they taught me, every single one of them said the same thing. Do seminars, even if it's in your living room. And my first seminar was in my living room. 4 people and a dog. And that's what started me off. And it definitely, definitely, definitely positions you beautifully because you're the one person who's willing to stand up. Even if you're fresh out the gate, you're willing to stand up there and put yourself in the front line and handle questions and be the expert. Very, very useful. Now, if you're smart, and this is something I didn't do and I really wish I really should have, is you record everything that you do. If you're going to stand up and speak anywhere, you record it.
Mm-hmm.
Because then duplicate it, you get a CD, you can then get it transcribed, turn it into a free report, turn it into an article, turn it into a book.
Mm-hmm.
I would have had a vast library by now. I've been talking for 16 years. I would have had an infinitely huge library. I'd probably retired by now had I recorded everything. Unfortunately, I didn't, but I am now. Once you've done a number of talks, once you've built up a number of audios, you've now got a little library which you can sell as a standalone product or give away as a bonus or whatever you want to do.
I'm with you.
So the masterclass library.
You know, is that more business for me then?
It's definitely more business for you.
Excellent.
So here's the exercise. What are some topics, what are some subjects, what are some areas that you'd happily stand up and talk about, or maybe not actually talk about in front of a group, but record on audio? Because again, you can position yourself just by recording an audio. Anyone who's producing an audio CD must be an expert in their field, surely. That's the basic assumption that works under. So utilise it, absolutely utilise it. Now, the point sometimes comes up, people go, well, isn't this a bit false? Isn't this lying? Isn't this kind of just dressing things up? Well, let me ask you, you spent a lot of time, energy and money learning your craft, haven't you?
Yeah.
You know way more than Joe Public about what you do.
Uh-huh.
So is it not true that you do actually specialise in an area?
Yes.
That the majority of the public know nothing about?
Yes.
And you've spent a lot of time and effort and money, invested a lot of stuff getting to this level. It's only fair that you get the return on your investment, surely.
Uh-huh.
That's what this is about. You're not lying, you're not stretching the truth. You're actually telling the truth. You know, being
knowledge is power.
Knowledge is power. Well, use of knowledge is power.
Yes, of knowledge.
Because armchair people don't get anywhere. So 5 minutes exercise. What are some of the topics, subjects that you could conduct seminars in? and a seminar needs only be a couple of hours, or you give talks in, or you give 10-minute speeches on, or you could record an audio for 80 minutes. Jot down some ideas, ones that you're particularly passionate about, ones that you know a lot about, ones that you are happy to answer questions and go deep into. The more passionate and excited you are about your subject, the less stage fright you'll have, because you'll get caught up in the enthusiasm that you've already got inside you. Again, emotions carry messages. Emotion is the FedEx of the unconscious mind. It carries messages to wherever you want it to go. So spend 5 minutes, write down some ideas, do that now. Strategy number six. Today's program was brought to you by the number six. Develop your own proprietary approach, technique, service, or method. Very interesting. Great example is a man in Scotland called Jack Black, who is probably arguably the most successful personal development speaker in Scotland, possibly the UK, for creating a product called Mindstore. Now, Mindstore for Life was a 2-day public program. He managed to fill the Glasgow Royal Concert Hall, which was his goal, which was, I think, over 1,000 people, maybe even 2,000 people. Jack was an ex-social worker who got into a technique called the Silva Mind Method, invented by Jose Silva many decades ago. And Jack effectively learned that and then repackaged it and turned it into his own brand of product. Now, if you study Jose Silva's methods and you study Mindstore, you're basically studying the same thing. However, in many ways, Jack Black's version of it, I think, was a lot more portable, a lot more user-friendly, a lot more sexy, a lot more accessible by the public. But all he did was develop his own version of it. So how can you package your product, your service, your treatment in a way that's unique and also has a unique name as well? Now, the name has to be tied into your positioning. So, for example, it could be the Brian Larkin Pain Relief Method.
Okay.
That makes sense. Or the Mentally Tough Mind Workout. Or Golf Yoga. It says what it does in the tin, and it's catchy and it's immediate. If you can come up with some kind of branding or some kind of personal approach to what you do, then you position yourself beautifully. I'll give a great example. A friend of mine, Jerry, one of the funniest men I've ever met in my life, he and I did a stand-up comedy thing at the festival once, but he's a terrible stutter. And originally, I worked with him as a therapy client because he found it really, really hard to say his own name. Now, he worked in a big organisation at the end of a phone, and people would continually phone, and when he picked up the phone, he couldn't say who he was. And that's kind of difficult. Now, he trained to be a life coach, and his concern was, well, how do I do life coaching if I can't actually say my name on the phone? That's going to make telephone coaching difficult.
Mm-hmm. Change his name.
He came up with something. He came up with something even more brilliant. He calls himself the Cyber Coach, and he does it all by instant messaging.
Right.
All of it. So clients log on their internet service provider. They get an anonymous nickname, so that he doesn't even actually know their real names. They don't know his real name. And right. He does all his coaching. Maybe you dial him at 7 o'clock on a Monday night, and he coaches you for an hour, all by instant message, on the screen, on the computer. Doesn't have to speak.
And they pay for the service.
Pay for the service. He's fully booked, international clients from all over the world, email him at different times of day. And he just sits at his computer and he's joggy buttons.
Eating Haagen-Dazs
and driving his Ferrari. The Cyber Coach. Check out his website. He's right there right now. In fact, I'll tell you right now, I'm sure Jay doesn't mind me saying this, he's back to Holland, he's moving to Spain. It's his 50th birthday, I think, the end of this month, and he's off to Spain to live with his wee boy. So he's made it, you know, fabulous. The Cyber Coach.
You can just see him on his laptop.
Absolutely, on the beach.
On Yahoo Messenger or MSN Messenger.
Exactly. Work anywhere in the world.
Yeah, webcam and all that.
Well,
glasses on.
No, that
a beard.
That's not anonymous anymore.
Well, no, you'd have a beard with dark glasses.
What kind of clients do you have? Now, the name obviously should infer the benefits of what you do. So the name has to be quite important. Great example of naming. You ever heard of a magazine called Esquire?
Oh yeah.
Esquire magazine was brilliant when gentlemen signed their name Brian Larkin Esquire. Now, when you think of the name Esquire, what comes to mind? What does that mean to you? What's the association?
Just exquisite gentlemen's gold watches.
Yeah, it's very gentlemen's club.
Yeah.
Prim and proper, upstanding, fine citizen, pillar of the community. Then a magazine came along that completely outmaneuvered it, called Playboy.
Yeah.
What does that bring to mind?
Cufflinks. Playboy Mansion.
Hef.
Perverted old Hef.
Yep.
Up there in the mansion. Bikinis.
Exactly.
I was resisting there.
I'm glad you bit your tongue.
I'm preconditioned.
I like it. Now, that's a fantastic example of naming, linking certain associations in the brain, but also positioning yourself. Look at the Playboy brand now. Mm. For goodness sake, it's a world renowned, the bunny symbol, everybody recognises it. Now, sometimes you can use the existing words, but change them around, thus changing their meaning. So an example I've seen done recently, there's the fair trade symbol, and the fair trade brand, have you seen that? Mm-hmm. I've also seen it completely repositioned by some other companies, who now call it fair to the trade, unfair to the consumer.
That's cheeky.
That is cheeky. But you know what? It's catchy, and it sticks in people's heads because it plays on an existing association. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
It's already there.
Now, naming is really important. Here's another example. Colgate Palmolive, massive corporation, produced Colgate brushes, Colgate toothpaste. They also produce Palmolive soap. There's Palmolive dishwashing liquid, and there's Palmolive shaving foam as part of their range. Now, there's another company called Procter & Gamble who carefully choose names for the products such as Tide or Bold. Now, which do you think sells most?
I'd be taking a guess. Both sound pretty well established.
They are. Massive corporations.
Gamble.
Procter & Gamble?
Yeah.
Procter & Gamble make 5 times the profit that Colgate Palmolive do. Because they name their products with names that make sense. So Bold washing powder makes stuff bolder. Tide is a washing powder as well. They make them brighter, make them cleaner. Whereas Colgate Palmolive call all their products by their company name.
Right.
People understand Bold better than they do Procter & Gamble. Okay. Would you go out and buy Procter & Gamble washing liquid? Probably not. Right. But you will buy Lenore, or you will buy a fabric softener by its name. Very, very important. Another example, the creators of neuro-linguistic programming, NLP, trained a young guy called Anthony Robbins. Now, they sell NLP, they sell neuro-linguistic programming, and they have up to maybe 700 people in the room. Tony Robbins sells Unleash the Power Within, and at last count had 10,000 people in the room. Again, the name's like a crowbar. It opens up the brain and it allows the message to penetrate. Would you rather learn to be a neuro-linguistic programmer, or would you rather unleash the power within yourself? It does what it says in the tin. Remember Ever-Ready batteries?
Yeah.
They were everywhere, absolutely everywhere. They were not blue with an orange label, a red label, if I remember rightly.
Mm-hmm.
Until a certain black and gold battery arrived, which you know as?
Duracell.
Duracell. So, have you ever seen an Ever-Ready battery since?
No.
No, do you know why?
You bought them over.
No, not at all. Not at all.
The
company who produced Ever-Ready batteries changed Ever-Ready batteries to Energizer.
Right.
And you've seen Energizer batteries.
Yeah.
That's the old Ever-Ready battery.
Change the name.
Change the name, compete with something that's got a similar foothold, and suddenly you stay in business where you could have been bought out. Very, very interesting. So, think about a proprietary name for your product, service or treatment, or a unique title, or some kind of brand word or buzzword or phrase that sums up what you do, that's benefit laden, that is your own personal phenomenon. It's your own personal approach. So spend some 5 minutes brainstorming that, and do that to the following music.
Welcome back after the break. Now we go to point 7, Jonathan.
Point 7.
What is 7?
Thank you, Brian. Point 7 is the against position.
Against position.
The against position. This is an interesting one. This requires some thought. The against position is when you tell the prospect what your product, service or treatment is not, rather than what it is. Now, this offsets it against and makes it stand out from all the other existing competitors. So let me give you some examples from history. What was the automobile originally called before it was an automobile?
Don't know.
The horseless carriage. Now, can I just ask you, did cars catch on? Yes, I think you did. You ever filled your car with unleaded petrol? I did tonight on my way here.
Yes.
Have you ever bought a reduced sugar drink?
Yes.
You probably have, haven't you? You ever put low-fat milk in your tea?
Yes.
These are all against position products.
Right.
They're telling you what they're not.
Okay.
Does that make sense? Now, there's a famous story which is quoted in marketing books about Avis Car Rental. Avis Car Rental, if I remember rightly, was always number two on the ladder because Hart's Car Rental was always first.
Mm-hmm.
So Avis Car Rental deliberately changed their positioning and their logo and their strap line, and they changed it to, Avis is only number two in rental cars, so why go with us? Because we try harder.
Interesting.
So they actively told everyone, we're number two on the list, and because we're number two, we'll do a hell of a better job than number one will.
Okay.
Because they can rest on the laurels, kind of thing. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And Avis, again, if you go to any airport, the first two you're going to see is Hart's Car Rental and then Avis. Interesting, interesting. Another interesting one was 7-Up. Do you remember 7-Up?
Mm-hmm.
Do you still get 7-Up?
I don't think you do.
Do you?
No,
I haven't seen it for a long time.
No.
When 7-Up was first launched, they did some market research, and the figures said that 2 out of every 3 soft drinks consumed in the Western world... I'll say this again. 2 out of every 3 soft drinks consumed in the Western world was either Pepsi-Cola or Coca-Cola. So 7-Up come along, and they want to produce this new clear, fizzy drink. So they promoted it. I don't remember what they promoted it as. You maybe don't remember this. But it was launched as the Un-Cola drink.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Because it wasn't brown.
Okay.
It was exactly the same as Coke or Pepsi, except the colour.
Was it really?
Yeah. And it was called the Un-Cola drink.
Right.
And that's how they got to number 3 in the ranking.
Okay.
They actually looked, they saw they were going to be number 3, so they grabbed it. Very interesting. So, bit of a mind stretch, but useful because very few people do this. Because it's a mind stretch, very few people can be bothered doing this. And if you're one of the ones who does, you position yourself beautifully. So think about this. What is your product, service, or treatment not? Or how can you offset it against what everyone else in your field is currently doing?
It still doesn't explain why it's called 7 up instead of 3 down.
I'll have to go now and find out. You see?
Yeah.
I'll have to go and find out. And we'll do that on the next audio.
That's why they don't sell it anymore.
That's why it's gone. Let's move on, shall we? Can you fancy a little French?
Parlez-vous français? Quelle heure est-il? Ferme la bouche, l'air. Merde. Merde.
Good. Bon. Cherchez le chrono. Is a little French expression for you. Yeah.
Maman.
Merci. Beaucoup. Which in French means look for the hole.
Really?
It does.
Need a stew for that.
Oh no. Look for the hole. Thank you. Which means go against the grain, buck the trend, swim in the opposite direction from the rest of the fish in the pond. Look for contexts that nobody else is filling. Look for holes in the marketing plan that no one else is going for. So to give an example, in the US, in the 70s, early 70s, every car in the 70s was either longer, lower, or wider. If you think back to some of the, you know, the Rockford Files, or you look back to Starsky and Hutch, all those kind of films, all those kind of TV cop shows that we used to watch as teenagers, or younger. All the cars were always lower, sleeker, longer, fatter, wider.
Right.
In the US, every car in the 70s was longer, lower, and wider, so Volkswagen introduced... Early 70s, famous car. Herbie rides again.
Banana boat.
The Volkswagen Beetle.
Yeah, oh, of course, I'm thinking Robin Reliant.
Right, right, okay.
Okay. Did that fill the hole?
Pardon? Did that fill the hole? Well, yeah.
I was thinking more about Herbie Goes Bananas.
Herbie did ride again, so maybe it did. You had a short, fat, ugly car with big spotlight headlights. Completely bucked the trend, completely went in the other direction, and was massive, massive success.
Betsy, when he rode again, he fell the hole. peeled. Sorry.
Okay, another context that you can look for is think price. Compare an Aston Martin Vanquish to a Vauxhall Astra. What's the difference?
Vanquish is a far more beautiful
one. Absolutely. Or a far more beautiful car, with no disrespect to Vauxhall Astras. Think about Lidl and Aldi compared to Sainsbury's.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you remember Fine Fair Yellow Pack products?
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Remember cheap biscuits, cheap coffee?
I actually had them when I went to school for my packed lunch.
Yeah.
And I had to eat in the toilets because, you know, I can't commit a status and all.
Absolutely.
That. I became a very good fighter as a result.
You stood up for the Yellow Pack rights.
Exactly.
A Yellow Pack rebel. I love it. A friend of mine went around to his house on a regular basis, and his mum just filled the fridge and cupboards with yellow pack products. And everything that was like the coffee, the sugar, the milk, the biscuits, everything was at yellow pack. Because it was cheaper and it was popular. And it was branded, you know, that yellow pack thing. Now, sex, remember that?
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that earlier. Sex sells. What do most perfumes rely on for marketing purposes?
Beautiful women selling it.
Exactly. Exactly. Often to other beautiful women.
Not advertising, or to other commercials. Women.
Yeah, exactly. The famous flake adverts.
Mm.
You know. So, again, watch your morals and ethics. However, sex does sell. Another context you use is age. So, for instance, you had SAGA holidays, or you still have SAGA holidays, SAGA bus trips, versus Club 18 to 30. Yeah, very, very targeted, very niche positioned, instantly understandable products and services. Here's another interesting weird one that I dug in my research. Time of day as a context. So, you had a whole bunch of medicinal products for colds and flus and symptoms like that. And then somebody brought out Night Nurse.
Right, or Midnight Limo.
Midnight Limo. You've got product services that are keyed to specific times of day. Yeah, or like you get kids' school box foods. You know, these cheese dipper type products, mm-hmm. which are specifically aimed at mothers to buy for their kids in the lunchbox.
Cheese string and all that.
All that kind of stuff, yeah. I was trying to think of dawn, is there any kind of dusk or dawn type products? But is there a time of day? Noon? Is there time, tea times? Is there? I still to this day remember Tony Blackburn on Radio 1 had his naughty bongos at 3 o'clock. And there was time for tea for 3, tea at 3 every day.
Andy Cameron's Sunday joint.
There you are. See?
Do you ever get stoned during that?
The breakfast the breakfast show. You know, drive time TV, all these drive time radio, all these things are geared at specific time of day. Maybe that's a niche you could exploit. Another interesting niche is the heavy user. So could you specialise your products or services for hardcore enthusiasts? So if you look at cycling, I bought myself a mountain bike for my birthday, and I was looking at the whole world of stuff to do with cycling things that I didn't know existed.
Mm.
You know, there's all sorts of stuff you can buy. Or hill walkers. There's a whole industry around hill walking clothes and gloves and hats and goggles and you know. The enthusiast, the heavy duty user, what would they do in your industry? You could target market them. Who are the real addicts, the real enthusiasts who just love what you do? And you could niche and position yourself specifically for them. That'd be a very interesting target market.
Mm.
So have a think about that. We've talked about size, talked about price, talked about sex, talked about age, talked about time of day and heavy use. Look for other contexts that you might want to look for. Are there any other comedy? Could you be the comedy coach? Are there other areas and contexts that are not being exploited that no one's filled that hole yet?
Sex coach.
Oh, that's been done. There's a lady called, she's on TV right now, the Sex Experts, she's called Cox as well.
Sexpert.
Yeah, that's one, yeah. Tracy Cox, I think, is on
there. Sarah Cox.
Sarah Cox? No, that's a different person altogether. So have a think of that. Spend 5 minutes, seriously, thinking about different chenaux that you can fill.
And keep it clean.
Moving swiftly along to strategy number 9, our last strategy on this audio. And this is an interesting one. If you can't knock the number one position off their ledge, could you get around them, over them, under them, past them, by moving them in the public's mind? Could you reposition the competition? That's strategy number 9. Great example illustrates this beautifully. Christopher Columbus said that the world was round. So I'm told. The public argued that it was flat, and if you sailed enough far away from the coastline, perpendicular to the coastline, you would eventually fall off the edge. Everyone knew that the world was flat, everyone believed that the world was flat, and history dictated that the world was flat, so therefore it must be true. Christopher Columbus was seen as a complete rebel and a miscreant for daring to suggest otherwise. Then 15th century scientists simply pointed out something really, really obvious. They said when a ship approaches over the horizon towards a beach or towards a harbour, what's the first thing you see?
A sail.
You see the mast, then you see the sails. What's the last thing you see?
Those on it.
The people on it and the hull of the ship. If the world was flat, you'd see the whole ship suddenly pop into view.
Yeah.
So it can't be. It has to be a curve. Simple, obvious, profound.
Yeah.
Undercut an existing concept or a product or service and you will have a simple, impactful and profound effect on the marketplace perception. Plus, people like to see the high and mighty torn down, brought down a peg or two. It's interesting that statistically more people watch The Weakest Link than watch Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. It's very, very interesting. Everybody likes to take a pop at the celebrities. Look at how many people have fallen from grace, and the public are right in there because they want to see it. It's a kind of vulture culture, as I call it. People like to pick off the bones and tear someone to pieces. So, in a dark corner of your mind is a box marked loser. And once someone gets put in that box, you mentioned the Hugh Grant thing earlier on, cut out with a prostitute or allegations thereof, and you can think of numerous other celebrities who have fallen into the same kind of trap. Once they are in that box called loser, the position's ruined. It's game over. So the way to position or reposition the competition is point out the flaws. Find a hole, find a weakness in their current position and point it out.
Just something that's just popped out of my head as you're saying that, Jonathan. While you are pointing out their weakness, would it be quite good to, essentially draw a comparison, like what the iMac PC thing,
yep,
to say what...
So explain that a little bit more for anyone who doesn't know what that's about.
Well, the iMac PC and Mac have had this online rivalry, this advertiser's rivalry, and they're using some minor celebrities to advertise it. The two guys from a Peep Show, the two characters, they're two very different characters. You've got one guy who's very sort of homely and quite set in his ways. I wouldn't say unattractive, but he's not, you know, your stereotypical handsome man. He's quite kind of dumpy, though he's intellectual. And then you get the other character who's a bit more kind of funky or cooler. He's still not a very handsome guy, but he is all about the fun. So what you've got there is you've kind of got two personalities, and basically what they're doing is they're categorizing computers with personality, and they're drawing, linking them together. So basically the whole thing is there's one commercial, you can see them online, where there's a guy, it's sneezing, it starts that commercial sneezing, oh, I've got another virus again, you better watch you don't catch it, this is the PC, because PCs are known to, you know, contain viruses and harbor viruses, but Macs don't get viruses, or seemingly as easy as PCs do, and the guy says, oh, don't come near me, you might catch what I've got, that's okay, you sneeze away, I'm fine, I'm off to, I'm off to play with a girlfriend or something like that, which is all about what the Mac's all about. So, but what they're saying is there's downs, not downsides. They're not saying that, okay, we're better than PCs, but we've got something that they don't have, or we've not got something that they have.
Or they're pointing out something
that is a weakness.
A lot of people already kind of suspect or think, but aren't maybe actually saying it right, and they're just jumping on it.
Metaphor and just
absolutely exploiting
it. It's an interesting thing.
So, to do that, you know, there's an interesting phrase I read. There's a famous couple of advertisers called Al Reese and Jack Trout, who've written several very interesting books about marketing. And one of the things they said was that the objective of your marketing should not be to educate your consumers at all. It should be to terrorise your competitors' copywriters, to send them back to the drawing board to rewrite it and start from scratch. A great example, again, be careful how you do this, but a great example was there's a lot of people who can't take aspirin as a drug, because aspirin is known to do several things. To anyone with some sort of stomach complaint, it's known to make it worse, and it has numerous side effects to a lot of people. So in the vast world of pharmaceuticals in the States, one particular company deliberately positioned its painkilling product as painkillers for people who can't take aspirin. And they actually listed all the side effects that aspirin can have with people. Now again, this is common knowledge, it's in the public domain, but no one was really saying it. Aspirin certainly don't want to say it, but the rival is quite happy to exploit it. So be very careful from a legal standpoint how you do this, and from an ethical standpoint as well, because all's fair in love and war. However, if there is a downside or a flaw in someone else's business, then you may want to consider repositioning them in the marketplace the minds of the marketplace by pointing out the flaw, or by linking your product or solution or treatment to the solution to that flaw. So the more popular they become, the more people learn about you. That's an interesting strategy. So have a think about that. Have a think about how can you undercut an existing concept or product or strong service position that's already out there, and use that to your advantage. Spend 5 minutes thinking about that, and then we're going to wrap this thing up. So, let's wrap this thing up.
Let's do that.
These are some ideas, some interesting concepts. Now, I'm actually quite jealous of you, because when I set up my business, I did not have any of these things. I didn't know any of these strategies, didn't know how they worked, had never crossed my mind. I literally just needed to make some money, so I went out and I offered things the best I could. Fortunately, that worked. Fortunately, I survived, and we're still here 16 years later. For those of you who know me, you'll notice that some of these strategies have been implemented in my business over the past couple of years, and interestingly enough, my turnover has trebled in the past couple of years. So if that's not a good enough reason to do it, I don't know what is. Think about some of these 9 different aspects. You may be able to take little snippets from each of them, but just suppose you found something that you could hang your hook on. What is that unique competitive advantage that you can offer? Or what is that position that you can now put your business into, which feels congruent, it feels right? Just imagine if your organisation became known for a particular niche or a particular combination that no one else offers. How well would that guarantee your future? How much more likely are you to reach your target if you're actually holding that position? Imagine yourself in the situation where people know you because of your brand, or know you because of your symbology, or know you because of your strapline, which has been built up over the years and cumulatively gets better. One of the things I always like to say to people is, this is as hard as it's going to get. It will never be this hard ever again. It's going to get easier and easier and easier. And the more of these strategies you implement and actually put into place in your business, the easier your business is going to go, the smoother things are going to work out for you, and the more longevity you build into your business. Now, you don't have to do positioning, but I promise you, if you don't, so you're still going to have a position. Whether you don't do positioning or whether you do do positioning, you've still got a position. If it's a crap position, if you're unknown and no one knows what you do, or you're an also-ran, then you're going to have to carve up your pie the same as everybody else does, and you're going to get the dregs and the crumbs like everybody else does. The only way to be able to raise yourself above the noise and to be heard and noticed in a very competitive world is to have very strong positioning that you stick to, and you continue to hone, you continue to buff up, and you continue to improve. And never, ever, ever let anything leave your office or your mouth or your computer that in any way dents or diminishes or harms your positioning. Think about Eddie Murphy. Think about celebrities who have gone awry. Think about rock stars who have left the beaten path and gone into other avenues. Look what it's done to their reputation and their standing and the perception in the public's viewpoint. That's what you want to be thinking about, because perception is reality. Hopefully you've enjoyed this little chat. I certainly have.
And I, for one, have most certainly enjoyed it. I'm off for some ice cream, and we're going to revisit the cardiology.
It's Friday night.
I've got a lot to think about.
We need to get your heart rate up again. So thanks for listening. We're going to be doing more of these, so look out for more of these programs. I hope you've enjoyed this. It's not going to do you any good sitting on your shelf. It's what you do that counts. Implement this stuff, and by all means, contact me and let me know how this works out for you. You can reach me through my website, which is jonathanclark.org. That's JonathanClark.org, or you can email me at inquiry@jonathanclark.org, or phone the free phone number 0800 072 5792, and you get your message through to me. I'd love to hear some success stories. I'd love to hear what this does for you. If you have any questions, by all means get in touch, and look out for the next special program that we're going to launch. It's been nice talking to you. Thanks for giving me your time and your investment of energy, and good luck in your business.
It's good night from me,
and it's good night from him. Thank you.